Barnaby Rudge, A Tale of the Riots of 80. Chapter 1. In the year 1775, there stood upon the borders of Epping Forest, at a distance of about 12 miles from London, measuring from the Standard in Cornhill, or rather from the spot on or near to which the Standard used to be in days of yore, a house of public entertainment called the Maypole, which fact was demonstrated to all such travellers as could neither read nor write, and at that time a vast number both of travellers and stay-at-homes were in this condition, by the emblem reared on the roadside over against the house, which, if not of those goodly proportions that maypoles were wont to present in olden times, was a fair young ash, 30 feet in height, and straight as any arrow that ever English yeoman drew. The maypole, by which term from henceforth is meant the house, and not its sign the maypole, was an old building, with more gable ends than a lazy man would care to count on a sunny day, huge zigzag chimneys, out of which it seemed as though even smoke could not choose but come in more than naturally fantastic shapes, imparted to it in its tortuous progress, and vast stables, gloomy, ruinous, and empty. The place was said to have been built in the days of King Henry VIII, and there was a legend, not only that Queen Elizabeth had slept there one night while upon a hunting excursion, to wit, in a certain oak-panelled room with a deep bay window, but that next morning, while standing on a mounting block before the door with one foot in the stirrup, the Virgin Monarch had then and there boxed and cuffed an unlucky page for some neglect of duty. The matter-of-fact and doubtful folks, of whom there were a few among the Maypole customers, as unluckily there always are in every little community, were inclined to look upon this tradition as rather apocryphal, but, whenever the landlord of that ancient hostelry appealed to the mounting block itself as evidence, and triumphantly pointed out that there it stood in the same place to that very day, the doubters never failed to be put down by a large majority, and all true believers exulted as in a victory. Whether these, and many other stories of the like nature, were true or untrue, the Maypole was really an old house, a very old house, perhaps as old as it claimed to be, and perhaps older, which will sometimes happen with houses of an uncertain, as with ladies of a certain, age. Its windows were old diamond pane lattices, its floors were sunken and uneven, its ceilings blackened by the hand of time, and heavy with massive beams. Over the doorway was an ancient porch, quaintly and grotesquely carved, and here on summer evenings the more favored customers smoked and drank hay, and sang many a good song too, sometimes reposing on two grim-looking high-backed settles, which, like the twin dragons of some fairy tale, guarded the entrance to the mansion. In the chimneys of the disused rooms, swallows had built their nests for many a long year, and from earliest spring to latest autumn whole colonies of sparrows chirped and twittered in the eaves. There were more pigeons about the dreary stable-yard and outbuildings than anybody but the landlord could reckon up. The wheeling and circling flights of runts, fantails, tumblers, and pouters, were perhaps not quite consistent with the grave and sober character of the building, but the monotonous cooing, which never ceased to be raised by some among them all day long, suited it exactly, and seemed to lull it to rest. With its overhanging stories, drowsy little panes of glass, and front bulging out and projecting over the pathway, the old house looked as if it were nodding in its sleep. Indeed, it needed no very great stretch of fancy to detect in it other resemblances to humanity. The bricks of which it was built had originally been a deep dark red, but had grown yellow and discolored like an old man's skin, the sturdy timbers had decayed like teeth, and here and there the ivy, like a warm garment to comfort it in its age, wrapped its green leaves closely round the time-worn walls. It was a hale and hearty age though, still, and in the summer or autumn evenings, when the glow of the setting sun fell upon the oak and chestnut trees of the adjacent forest, the old house, partaking of its luster, seemed their fit companion, and to have many good years of life in him yet. The evening with which we have to do, was neither a summer nor an autumn one, but the twilight of a day in March, when the wind howled dismally among the bare branches of the trees, and rumbling in the wide chimneys and driving the rain against the windows of the Maypole Inn, gave such of its frequenters as chanced to be there at the moment an undeniable reason for prolonging their stay, and caused the landlord to prophesy that the night would certainly clear at 11 o'clock precisely, which by a remarkable coincidence was the hour at which he always closed his house. The name of him upon whom the spirit of prophecy thus descended was John Willett, a burly, large-headed man with a fat face, which betokened profound obstinacy and slowness of apprehension, combined with a very strong reliance upon his own merits. It was John Willett's ordinary boast in his more placid moods that if he were slow he was sure, which assertion could, in one sense at least, be by no means gainsaid, seeing that he was in everything unquestionably the reverse of fast, and withal one of the most dogged and positive fellows in existence, always sure that what he thought or said or did was right, and holding it as a thing quite settled and ordained by the laws of nature and providence, that anybody who said or did or thought otherwise must be inevitably and of necessity wrong. Mr. Willett walked slowly up to the window, flattened his fat nose against the cold glass, and shading his eyes that his sight might not be affected by the ruddy glow of the fire, looked abroad. Then he walked slowly back to his old seat in the chimney corner, and, composing himself in it with a slight shiver, such as a man might give way to and so acquire an additional relish for the warm blaze, said, looking round upon his guests, "It'll clear at 11 o'clock. No sooner and no later. Not before and not afterwards." "How do you make out that?" said a little man in the opposite corner. "The moon is past the full, and she rises at 9. John looked sedately and solemnly at his questioner until he had brought his mind to bear upon the whole of his observation, and then made answer, in a tone which seemed to imply that the moon was peculiarly his business and nobody else's. "Never you mind about the moon. Don't you trouble yourself about her. You let the moon alone, and I'll let you alone." "No offense, I hope?" said the little man. Again John waited leisurely until the observation had thoroughly penetrated to his brain, and then replying, "No offense as yet," applied a light to his pipe and smoked in placid silence, now and then casting a sidelong look at a man wrapped in a loose riding coat with huge cuffs ornamented with tarnished silver lace and large metal buttons, who sat apart from the regular frequenters of the house, and wearing a hat flapped over his face, which was still further shaded by the hand on which his forehead rested, looked unsociable enough. There was another guest, who sat, booted and spurred, at some distance from the fire also, and whose thoughts, to judge from his folded arms and knitted brows, and from the untasted liquor before him, were occupied with other matters than the topics under discussion or the persons who discussed them. This was a young man of about 8 and 20, rather above the middle height, and though of somewhat slight figure, gracefully and strongly made. He wore his own dark hair, and was accoutred in a riding dress, which together with his large boots, resembling in shape and fashion those worn by our life guardsmen at the present day, showed indisputable traces of the bad condition of the roads. But travel-stained though he was well and even richly attired, and without being overdressed looked a gallant gentleman. Lying upon the table beside him, as he had carelessly thrown them down, were a heavy riding whip and a slouched hat, the latter worn no doubt as being best suited to the inclemency of the weather. There, too, were a pair of pistols in a holster case, and a short riding cloak. Little of his face was visible, except the long dark lashes which concealed his downcast eyes, but an air of careless ease and natural gracefulness of demeanor pervaded the figure, and seemed to comprehend even those slight accessories, which were all handsome, and in good keeping. Towards this young gentleman the eyes of Mr. Willett wandered but once, and that as if in mute inquiry whether he had observed his silent neighbor. It was plain that John and the young gentleman had often met before. Finding that his look was not returned, or indeed observed by the person to whom it was addressed, John gradually concentrated the whole power of his eyes into one focus, and brought it to bear upon the man in the flapped hat, at whom he came to stare in course of time with an intensity so remarkable, that it affected his fireside cronies, who all, as with one accord, took their pipes from their lips, and stared with open mouths at the stranger likewise. The sturdy landlord had a large pair of dull fish-like eyes, and the little man who had hazarded the remark about the moon, and who was the parish clerk and bell-ringer of Chigwell, a village hard by, had little round black shiny eyes like beads. Moreover, this little man wore at the knees of his rusty black breeches, and on his rusty black coat, and all down his long flapped waistcoat, little queer buttons like nothing except his eyes, but so like them, that as they twinkled and glistened in the light of the fire, which shone too in his bright shoe buckles, he seemed all eyes from head to foot, and to be gazing with every one of them at the unknown customer. No wonder that a man should grow restless under such an inspection as this, to say nothing of the eyes belonging to Short Tom Cobb the general chandler and post office keeper, and Long Phil Parks the ranger, both of whom, infected by the example of their companions, regarded him of the flapped hat no less attentively. The stranger became restless, perhaps from being exposed to this raking fire of eyes, perhaps from the nature of his previous meditations, most probably from the latter cause, for as he changed his position and looked hastily round, he started to find himself the object of such keen regard, and darted an angry and suspicious glance at the fireside group. It had the effect of immediately diverting all eyes to the chimney, except those of John Willett, who, finding himself, as it were, caught in the fact, and not being, as has been already observed, of a very ready nature, remained staring at his guest in a particularly awkward and disconcerted manner. "Well?" said the stranger. "Well." There was not much in "well." It was not a long speech. "I thought you gave an order," said the landlord, after a pause of 2 or 3 minutes for consideration. The stranger took off his hat, and disclosed the hard features of a man of 60 or thereabouts, much weather-beaten and worn by time, and the naturally harsh expression of which was not improved by a dark handkerchief which was bound tightly round his head, and, while it served the purpose of a wig, shaded his forehead, and almost hid his eyebrows. If it were intended to conceal or divert attention from a deep gash, now healed into an ugly seam, which when it was first inflicted must have laid bare his cheekbone, the object was but indifferently attained, for it could scarcely fail to be noted at a glance. His complexion was of a cadaverous hue, and he had a grisly jagged beard of some 3 weeks' date. Such was the figure, very meanly and poorly clad, that now rose from the seat, and stalking across the room sat down in a corner of the chimney, which the politeness or fears of the little clerk very readily assigned to him. "A highwayman," whispered Tom Cobb to Parks the ranger. "Do you suppose highwaymen don't dress handsomer than that?" replied Parks. "It's a better business than you think for, Tom, and highwaymen don't need or use to be shabby, take my word for it." Meanwhile the subject of their speculations had done due honor to the house by calling for some drink, which was promptly supplied by the landlord's son Joe, a broad-shouldered strapping young fellow of 20, whom it pleased his father still to consider a little boy, and to treat accordingly. Stretching out his hands to warm them by the blazing fire, the man turned his head towards the company, and after running his eye sharply over them, said in a voice well suited to his appearance, "What house is that which stands a mile or so from here?"
"Public house?"
said the landlord, with his usual deliberation.
"Public house, father!" exclaimed Joe, "where's the public house within a mile or so of the Maypole?"
"He means the great house, the Warren, naturally, and of course. The old red brick house, sir, that stands in its own grounds?"
"Aye," said the stranger.
"And that 15 or 20 years ago stood in a park 5 times as broad, which with other and richer property has bit by bit changed hands and dwindled away, more's the pity," pursued the young man.
"Maybe," was the reply. "But my question related to the owner. What it has been I don't care to know, and what it is I can see for myself."
The heir apparent to the Maypole pressed his finger on his lips, and glancing at the young gentleman already noticed, who had changed his attitude when the house was first mentioned, replied in a lower tone, "The owner's name is Haredale, Mr. Geoffrey Haredale," and again he glanced in the same direction as before, and a worthy gentleman to him. Paying as little regard to this admonitory cough, as to the significant gesture that had preceded it, the stranger pursued his questioning. "I turned out of my way coming here, and took the footpath that crosses the grounds. Who is the young lady that I saw entering a carriage?"
"His daughter?"
"Why, how should I know, honest man?" replied Joe, contriving in the course of some arrangements about the hearth, to advance close to his questioner and pluck him by the sleeve. "I didn't see the young lady, you know. Phew! There's the wind again and rain. Well, it is a night."
"Rough weather indeed," observed the strange man.
"You are used to it?" said Joe, catching at anything which seemed to promise a diversion of the subject.
"Pretty well," returned the other.
"About the young lady, has Mr. Haredale a daughter?"
"No, no," said the young fellow fretfully, "he's a single gentleman. His be quiet, can't you, man? Don't you see this talk is not relished yonder?"
Regardless of this whispered remonstrance, and affecting not to hear it, his tormentor provokingly continued, "Single men have had daughters before now. Perhaps she may be his daughter, though he is not married."
"What do you mean?"
said Joe, adding in an undertone as he approached him again, "you'll come in for it presently, I know you will."
"I mean no harm," returned the traveler boldly, "and have said none that I know of. I ask a few questions as any stranger may, and not unnaturally, about the inmates of a remarkable house in a neighborhood which is new to me, and you are as aghast and disturbed as if I were talking treason against King George. Perhaps you can tell me why, sir, for, as I say, I am a stranger, and this is Greek to me?"
The latter observation was addressed to the obvious cause of Joe Willett's discomposure, who had risen and was adjusting his riding cloak preparatory to sallying abroad. Briefly replying that he could give him no information, the young man beckoned to Joe, and handing him a piece of money in payment of his reckoning, hurried out attended by young Willett himself, who taking up a candle followed to light him to the house door. While Joe was absent on this errand, the elder Willett and his 3 companions continued to smoke with profound gravity, and in a deep silence, each having his eyes fixed on a huge copper boiler that was suspended over the fire. After some time John Willett slowly shook his head, and thereupon his friends slowly shook theirs, but no man withdrew his eyes from the boiler, or altered the solemn expression of his countenance in the slightest degree. At length Joe returned very talkative and conciliatory, as though with a strong presentiment that he was going to be found fault with. "Such a thing as love is," he said, drawing a chair near the fire,
and looking round for sympathy? He has set off to walk to London, all the way to London. His nag gone lame in riding out here this blessed afternoon, and comfortably littered down in our stable at this minute, and he giving up a good hot supper in our best bed, because Miss Haredale has gone to a masquerade up in town, and he has set his heart upon seeing her. I don't think I could persuade myself to do that, beautiful as she is, but then I'm not in love, at least I don't think I am, and that's the whole difference.
He is in love then? Said the stranger.
Rather, replied Joe. He'll never be more in love, and may very easily be less.
Silence, sir! Cried his father. What a chap you are, Joe! Said Long Parks.
Such an inconsiderate lad! Murmured Tom Cobb. Putting himself forward and wringing the very nose off his own father's face! Exclaimed the parish clerk, metaphorically.
What have I done? Reasoned poor Joe.
Silence, sir! Returned his father, what do you mean by talking, when you see people that are more than two or three times your age, sitting still and silent and not dreaming of saying a word?
Why, that's the proper time for me to talk, isn't it? Said Joe rebelliously.
The proper time, sir! Retorted his father, the proper time's no time.
Ought to be sure! Muttered Parks, nodding gravely to the other two who nodded likewise, observing under their breaths that that was the point.
The proper time's no time, sir, repeated John Willett. When I was your age I never talked, I never wanted to talk. I listened and improved myself, that's what I did.
And you'd find your father rather a tough customer in argument, Joe, if anybody was to try and tackle him, said Parks.
For the matter of that, Phil, observed Mr. Willett, blowing a long, thin, spiral cloud of smoke out of the corner of his mouth, and staring at it abstractedly as it floated away, for the matter of that, Phil, argument is a gift of nature. If nature has gifted a man with powers of argument, a man has a right to make the best of them, and has not a right to stand on false delicacy, and deny that he is so gifted, for that is a turning of his back on nature, a flouting of her, a slighting of her precious caskets, and a proving of oneself to be a swine that isn't worth her scattering pearls before. The landlord pausing here for a very long time, Mr. Parks naturally concluded that he had brought his discourse to an end, and therefore, turning to the young man with some austerity, exclaimed,
"You hear what your father says, Joe? You wouldn't much like to tackle him in argument, I'm thinking, sir."
"If," said John Willett, turning his eyes from the ceiling to the face of his interrupter, and uttering the monosyllable in capitals, to apprise him that he had put in his oar, as the vulgar say, with unbecoming and irreverent haste, "if, sir, nature has fixed upon me the gift of argument, why should I not own to it, and rather glory in the same? Yes, sir, I am a tough customer that way. You are right, sir. My toughness has been proved, sir, in this room many and many a time, as I think you know, and if you don't know," added John, putting his pipe in his mouth again, "so much the better, for I ain't proud and am not going to tell you." A general murmur from his three cronies, and a general shaking of heads at the copper boiler, assured John Willett that they had a good experience of his powers and needed no further evidence to assure them of his superiority. John smoked with a little more dignity and surveyed them in silence.
"It's all very fine talking," muttered Joe, who had been fidgeting in his chair with divers uneasy gestures. "But if you mean to tell me that I'm never to open my lips—"
"Silence, sir!" roared his father.
"No, you never are. When your opinion's wanted, you give it. When you're spoke to, you speak. When your opinion's not wanted and you're not spoke to, don't you give an opinion and don't you speak. The world's undergone a nice alteration since my time, certainly. My belief is that there aren't any boys left, that there isn't such a thing as a boy, that there's nothing now between a male baby and a man, and that all the boys went out with His Blessed Majesty King George II.
"That's a very true observation, always excepting the young princes," said the parish clerk, who, as the representative of church and state in that company, held himself bound to the nicest loyalty. "If it's godly and righteous for boys, being of the ages of boys, to behave themselves like boys, then the young princes must be boys and cannot be otherwise."
"Did you ever hear tell of mermaids, sir?" said Mr. Willett.
"Certainly I have," replied the clerk.
"Very good," said Mr. Willett. "According to the constitution of mermaids, so much of a mermaid as is not a woman must be a fish. According to the constitution of young princes, so much of a young prince, if anything, as is not actually an angel, must be godly and righteous. Therefore if it's becoming and godly and righteous in the young princes, as it is at their ages, that they should be boys, they are and must be boys, and cannot by possibility be anything else."
This elucidation of a naughty point being received with such marks of approval as to put John Willett into a good humor, he contented himself with repeating to his son his command of silence, and addressing the stranger, said, "If you had asked your questions of a grown-up person of me or any of these gentlemen, you'd have had some satisfaction, and wouldn't have wasted breath. Miss Haredale is Mr. Geoffrey Haredale's niece."
"Is her father alive?"
said the man, carelessly.
"No," rejoined the landlord, "he is not alive, and he is not dead."
"Not dead?" cried the other.
"Not dead in a common sort of way," said the landlord.
The cronies nodded to each other, and Mr. Parks remarked in an undertone, shaking his head meanwhile as who should say, "Let no man contradict me, for I won't believe him," that John Willett was an amazing force tonight, and fit to tackle a chief justice. The stranger suffered a short pause to elapse, and then asked abruptly, "What do you mean?"
"More than you think for, friend," returned John Willett. "Perhaps there's more meaning in them words than you suspect."
"Perhaps there is," said the strange man, gruffly, "but what the devil do you speak in such mysteries for? You tell me, first, that a man is not alive, nor yet dead then, that he's not dead in a common sort of way then, that you mean a great deal more than I think for. To tell you the truth, you may do that easily, for so far as I can make out, you mean nothing. What do you mean, I ask again?"
"That," returned the landlord, a little brought down from his dignity by the stranger's surliness, "is a maypole story, and has been any time these 24 years. That story is Solomon Daisy's story. It belongs to the house, and nobody but Solomon Daisy has ever told it under this roof, or ever shall, that's more."
The man glanced at the parish clerk, whose air of consciousness and importance plainly betokened him to be the person referred to, and, observing that he had taken his pipe from his lips, after a very long whiff to keep it alight, and was evidently about to tell his story without further solicitation, gathered his large coat about him, and shrinking further back was almost lost in the gloom of the spacious chimney corner, except when the flame, struggling from under a great faggot, whose weight almost crushed it for the time, shot upward with a strong and sudden glare, and illumining his figure for a moment, seemed afterwards to cast it into deeper obscurity than before. By this flickering light, which made the old room, with its heavy timbers and panelled walls, look as if it were built of polished ebony, the wind roaring and howling without, now rattling the latch and creaking the hinges of the stout oaken door, and now driving at the casement as though it would beat it in by this light, and under circumstances so auspicious, Solomon Daisy began his tale. It was Mr. Reuben Haredale, Mr. Geoffrey's elder brother. Here he came to a dead stop, and made so long a pause that even John Willett grew impatient and asked why he did not proceed.
"Cobb," said Solomon Daisy, dropping his voice and appealing to the post office keeper, "what day of the month is this?"
"The 19th.
"Of March," said the clerk, bending forward, "the 19th of March, that's very strange." In a low voice they all acquiesced, and Solomon went on. "It was Mr. Reuben Haredale, Mr. Geoffrey's elder brother, that 22 years ago was the owner of the Warren, which, as Joe has said, not that you remember it, Joe, for a boy like you can't do that, but because you have often heard me say so, was then a much larger and better place, and a much more valuable property than it is now. His lady was lately dead, and he was left with one child, the Miss Haredale you have been inquiring about, who was then scarcely a year old." Although the speaker addressed himself to the man who had shown so much curiosity about this same family, and made a pause here as if expecting some exclamation of surprise or encouragement, the latter made no remark, nor gave any indication that he heard or was interested in what was said. Solomon therefore turned to his old companions, whose noses were brightly illuminated by the deep red glow from the bowls of their pipes, assured, by long experience, of their attention, and resolved to show his sense of such indecent behavior. "Mr. Haredale," said Solomon, turning his back upon the strange man, "left this place when his lady died, feeling it lonely like, and went up to London, where he stopped some months, but finding that place as lonely as this, as I suppose and have always heard say, he suddenly came back again with his little girl to the Warren, bringing with him besides, that day, only 2 women servants, and his steward, and a gardener." Mr. Daisy stopped to take a whiff at his pipe, which was going out, and then proceeded at first in a snuffling tone, occasioned by keen enjoyment of the tobacco and strong pulling at the pipe, and afterwards with increasing distinctness. "Bringing with him 2 women servants, and his steward, and a gardener. The rest stopped behind up in London, and were to follow next day. It happened that that night, an old gentleman who lived at Chigwell Row, and had long been poorly, deceased, and an order came to me at 12:30 at night to go and toll the passing bell." There was a movement in the little group of listeners,
sufficiently indicative of the strong repugnance any one of them would have felt to have turned out at such a time upon such an errand. The clerk felt and understood it, and pursued his theme accordingly. It was a dreary thing, especially as the gravedigger was laid up in his bed, from long working in a damp soil and sitting down to take his dinner on cold tombstones, and I was consequently under obligation to go alone, for it was too late to hope to get any other companion. However, I wasn't unprepared for it, as the old gentleman had often made it a request that the bell should be tolled as soon as possible after the breath was out of his body, and he had been expected to go for some days. I put as good a face upon it as I could, and muffling myself up, for it was mortal cold, started out with a lighted lantern in one hand and the key of the church in the other. At this point of the narrative, the dress of the strange man rustled as if he had turned himself to hear more distinctly. Slightly pointing over his shoulder, Solomon elevated his eyebrows and nodded a silent inquiry to Joe whether this was the case. Joe shaded his eyes with his hand and peered into the corner, but could make out nothing, and so shook his head. It was just such a night as this, blowing a hurricane, raining heavily, and very dark. I often think now, darker than I ever saw it before or since, that may be my fancy, but the houses were all close shut and the folks indoors, and perhaps there is only one other man who knows how dark it really was. I got into the church, chained the door back so that it should keep ajar for, to tell the truth, I didn't like to be shut in there alone, and putting my lantern on the stone seat in the little corner where the bell rope is, sat down beside it to trim the candle. I sat down to trim the candle, and when I had done so I could not persuade myself to get up again, and go about my work. I don't know how it was, but I thought of all the ghost stories I had ever heard, even those that I had heard when I was a boy at school, and had forgotten long ago, and they didn't come into my mind one after another, but all crowding at once, like. I recollected one story there was in the village, how that on a certain night in the year, it might be that very night for anything I knew, all the dead people came out of the ground and sat at the heads of their own graves till morning. This made me think how many people I had known, were buried between the church door and the churchyard gate, and what a dreadful thing it would be to have to pass among them and know them again, so earthy and unlike themselves. I had known all the niches and arches in the church from a child, still, I couldn't persuade myself that those were their natural shadows which I saw on the pavement, but felt sure there were some ugly figures hiding among them and peeping out. Thinking on in this way, I began to think of the old gentleman who was just dead, and I could have sworn, as I looked up the dark chancel, that I saw him in his usual place, wrapping his shroud about him and shivering as if he felt it cold. All this time I sat listening and listening, and hardly dared to breathe. At length I started up and took the bell rope in my hands. At that minute there rang not that bell, for I had hardly touched the rope but another. I heard the ringing of another bell, and a deep bell too, plainly. It was only for an instant, and even then the wind carried the sound away, but I heard it. I listened for a long time, but it rang no more. I had heard of corpse candles, and at last I persuaded myself that this must be a corpse bell tolling of itself at midnight for the dead. I told my bell how, or how long, I don't know, and ran home to bed as fast as I could touch the ground. I was up early next morning after a restless night, and told the story to my neighbors. Some were serious and some made light of it. I don't think anybody believed it real. But, that morning, Mr. Reuben Haredale was found murdered in his bedchamber, and in his hand was a piece of the cord attached to an alarm bell outside the roof, which hung in his room and had been cut asunder, no doubt by the murderer, when he seized it. That was the bell I heard. A bureau was found opened, and a cash box, which Mr. Haredale had brought down that day, and was supposed to contain a large sum of money, was gone. The steward and gardener were both missing and both suspected for a long time, but they were never found, though hunted far and wide. And far enough they might have looked for poor Mr. Rudge the steward, whose body scarcely to be recognized by his clothes and the watch and ring he wore was found, months afterwards, at the bottom of a piece of water in the grounds, with a deep gash in the breast where he had been stabbed with a knife. He was only partly dressed, and people all agreed that he had been sitting up reading in his own room, where there were many traces of blood, and was suddenly fallen upon and killed before his master. Everybody now knew that the gardener must be the murderer, and though he has never been heard of from that day to this, he will be, mark my words. The crime was committed this day 2 and 20 years on the 19th of March, 1753. On the 19th of March in some year, no matter when I know it, I am sure of it, for we have always, in some strange way or other, been brought back to the subject on that day ever since. On the 19th of March in some year, sooner or later, that man will be discovered. Chapter 2. A strange story, said the man who had been the cause of the narration. Stranger still if it comes about as you predict. Is that all? A question so unexpected, nettled Solomon Daisy not a little. By dint of relating the story very often, and ornamenting it, according to village report, with a few flourishes suggested by the various hearers from time to time, he had come by degrees to tell it with great effect, and is that all? After the climax, was not what he was accustomed to. Is that all? He repeated, yes, that's all, sir. And enough too, I think. I think so too. My horse, young man. He is but a hack hired from a roadside posting house, but he must carry me to London tonight.
Tonight, said Joe.
Tonight, returned the other. What do you stare at? This tavern would seem to be a house of call for all the gaping idlers of the neighborhood. At this remark, which evidently had reference to the scrutiny he had undergone, as mentioned in the foregoing chapter, the eyes of John Willett and his friends were diverted with marvelous rapidity to the copper boiler again. Not so with Joe, who, being a meddlesome fellow, returned the stranger's angry glance with a steady look, and rejoined. It is not a very bold thing to wonder at your going on tonight. Surely you have been asked such a harmless question in an inn before, and in better weather than this. I thought you mightn't know the way, as you seem strange to this part.
The way, repeated the other, irritably.
Yes. Do you know it? I'll find it, replied the man, waving his hand and turning on his heel. Landlord, take the reckoning here. John Willett did as he was desired, for on that point he was seldom slow, except in the particulars of giving change, and testing the goodness of any piece of coin that was proffered to him, by the application of his teeth or his tongue, or some other test, or in doubtful cases, by long series of tests terminating in its rejection. The guest then wrapped his garments about him so as to shelter himself as effectually as he could from the rough weather, and without any word or sign of farewell betook himself to the stable yard. Here Joe, who had left the room on the conclusion of their short dialogue, was protecting himself and the horse from the rain under the shelter of an old penthouse roof.
He's pretty much of my opinion, said Joe, patting the horse upon the neck. I'll wager that your stopping here tonight would please him better than it would please me.
He and I are of different opinions, as we have been more than once on our way here, was the short reply.
So I was thinking before you came out, for he has felt your spurs, poor beast.
The stranger adjusted his coat collar about his face, and made no answer.
You'll know me again, I see, he said, marking the young fellow's earnest gaze, when he had sprung into the saddle.
The man's worth knowing, master, who travels a road he don't know, mounted on a jaded horse, and leaves good quarters to do it on such a night as this.
You have sharp eyes and a sharp tongue, I find.
Both I hope by nature, but the last grows rusty sometimes for want of using.
Use the first less too, and keep their sharpness for your sweethearts, boy, said the man.
So saying he shook his hand from the bridle, struck him roughly on the head with the butt end of his whip, and galloped away, dashing through the mud and darkness with a headlong speed, which few badly mounted horsemen would have cared to venture, even had they been thoroughly acquainted with the country, and which, to one who knew nothing of the way he rode, was attended at every step with great hazard and danger. The roads, even within 12 miles of London, were at that time ill-paved, seldom repaired, and very badly made. The way this rider traversed had been ploughed up by the wheels of heavy wagons, and rendered rotten by the frosts and thaws of the preceding winter, or possibly of many winters. Great holes and gaps had been worn into the soil, which, being now filled with water from the late rains, were not easily distinguishable even by day, and a plunge into any one of them might have brought down a surer-footed horse than the poor beast now urged forward to the utmost extent of his powers. Sharp flints and stones rolled from under his hoofs continually, the rider could scarcely see beyond the animal's head, or farther on either side than his own arm would have extended. At that time, too, all the roads in the neighborhood of the metropolis were infested by footpads or highwaymen, and it was a night, of all others, in which any evil-disposed person of this class might have pursued his unlawful calling with little fear of detection. Still, the traveler dashed forward at the same reckless pace, regardless alike of the dirt and wet which flew about his head, the profound darkness of the night, and the probability of encountering some desperate characters abroad. At every turn and angle, even where a deviation from the direct course might have been least expected, and could not possibly be seen until he was close upon it, he guided the bridle with an unerring hand, and kept the middle of the road. Thus he sped onward, raising himself in the stirrups, leaning his body forward until it almost touched the horse's neck, and flourishing his heavy whip above his head with the fervor of a madman. There are times when, the elements being in unusual commotion, those who are bent on daring enterprises, or agitated by great thoughts, whether of good or evil, feel a mysterious sympathy with the tumult of nature, and are roused into corresponding violence. In the midst of thunder, lightning, and storm, many tremendous deeds have been committed. Men, self-possessed before, have given a sudden loose to passions they could no longer control. The demons of wrath and despair have striven to emulate those who ride the whirlwind and direct the storm, and man, lashed into madness with the roaring winds and boiling waters, has become for the time as wild and merciless as the elements themselves. Whether the traveler was possessed by thoughts which the fury of the night had heated and stimulated into a quicker current, or was merely impelled by some strong motive to reach his journey's end, on he swept more like a hunted phantom than a man, nor checked his pace until, arriving at some crossroads, one of which led by a longer route to the place whence he had lately started, he bore down so suddenly upon a vehicle which was coming towards him, that in the effort to avoid it he well nigh pulled his horse upon his haunches, and narrowly escaped being thrown.
"Yo-ho!" cried the voice of a man.
"What's that? Who goes there?"
"A friend," replied the traveler.
"A friend," repeated the voice. "Who calls himself a friend and rides like that, abusing heaven's gifts in the shape of horseflesh, and endangering, not only his own neck, which might be no great matter, but the necks of other people?"
"You have a lantern there, I see," said the traveler dismounting. "Lend it me for a moment. You have wounded my horse, I think, with your shaft or wheel."
"Wounded him?" cried the other. "If I haven't killed him, it's no fault of yours. What do you mean by galloping along the king's highway like that, eh?"
"Give me the light," returned the traveler, snatching it from his hand, "and don't ask idle questions of a man who is in no mood for talking."
"If you had said you were in no mood for talking before, I should perhaps have been in no mood for lighting," said the voice. "Howsoever, as it's the poor horse that's damaged and not you, one of you is welcome to the light at all events, but it's not the crusty one."
The traveler returned no answer to this speech, but holding the light near to his panting and reeking beast, examined him in limb and carcass. Meanwhile, the other man sat very composedly in his vehicle, which was a kind of chaise with a depository for a large bag of tools, and watched his proceedings with a careful eye. The looker-on was a round, red-faced, sturdy yeoman, with a double chin, and a voice husky with good living, good sleeping, good humor, and good health. He was past the prime of life, but Father Time is not always a hard parent, and, though he tarries for none of his children, often lays his hand lightly upon those who have used him well, making them old men and women inexorably enough, but leaving their hearts and spirits young and in full vigor. With such people the gray head is but the impression of the old fellow's hand in giving them his blessing, and every wrinkle but a notch in the quiet calendar of a well-spent life. The person whom the traveler had so abruptly encountered was of this kind: bluff, hale, hearty, and in a green old age, at peace with himself, and evidently disposed to be so with all the world. Although muffled up in divers coats and handkerchiefs, one of which, passed over his crown, and tied in a convenient crease of his double chin, secured his three-cornered hat and bob wig from blowing off his head, there was no disguising his plump and comfortable figure, neither did certain dirty finger marks upon his face give it any other than an odd and comical expression, through which its natural good humor shone with undiminished luster.
"He is not hurt," said the traveler at length, raising his head and the lantern together.
"You have found that out at last, have you?" rejoined the old man. "My eyes have seen more light than yours, but I wouldn't change with you."
"What do you mean?"
"Mean? I could have told you he wasn't hurt, 5 minutes ago. Give me the light, friend, ride forward at a gentler pace, and good night." In handing up the lantern, the man necessarily cast its rays full on the speaker's face. Their eyes met at the instant. He suddenly dropped it and crushed it with his foot.
"Did you never see a locksmith before, that you start as if you had come upon a ghost?" cried the old man in the chaise. "Or is this," he added hastily, thrusting his hand into the tool basket and drawing out a hammer, "a scheme for robbing me? I know these roads, friend. When I travel them, I carry nothing but a few shillings, and not a crown's worth of them. I tell you plainly, to save us both trouble, that there's nothing to be got from me but a pretty stout arm considering my years, and this thule, which, mayhap from long acquaintance with, I can use pretty briskly. You shall not have it all your own way, I promise you, if you play at that game." With these words he stood upon the defensive.
"I am not what you take me for, Gabriel Varden," replied the other.
"Then what and who are you?" returned the locksmith.
"You know my name, it seems. Let me know yours."
"I have not gained the information from any confidence of yours, but from the inscription on your cart which tells it to all the town," replied the traveller.
"You have better eyes for that than you had for your horse, then," said Varden, descending nimbly from his chaise. "Who are you? Let me see your face."
While the locksmith alighted, the traveler had regained his saddle, from which he now confronted the old man, who, moving as the horse moved in chafing under the tightened rein, kept close beside him.
"Let me see your face, I say. Stand off.
No masquerading tricks," said the locksmith, "and tales at the club tomorrow, how Gabriel Varden was frightened by a surly voice and a dark night. Stand, let me see your face." Finding that further resistance would only involve him in a personal struggle with an antagonist by no means to be despised, the traveler threw back his coat, and stooping down looked steadily at the locksmith. Perhaps two men more powerfully contrasted, never opposed each other face to face. The ruddy features of the locksmith so set off and heightened the excessive paleness of the man on horseback, that he looked like a bloodless ghost, while the moisture, which hard riding had brought out upon his skin, hung there in dark and heavy drops, like dews of agony and death. The countenance of the old locksmith lighted up with the smile of one expecting to detect in this unpromising stranger some latent roguery of eye or lip, which should reveal a familiar person in that arch disguise, and spoil his jest. The face of the other, sullen and fierce, but shrinking too, was that of a man who stood at bay, while his firmly closed jaws, his puckered mouth, and more than all a certain stealthy motion of the hand within his breast, seemed to announce a desperate purpose very foreign to acting, or child's play. Thus they regarded each other for some time, in silence.
"Humphrey," he said when he had scanned his features, "I don't know you."
"Don't desire to question Mark," returned the other, muffling himself as before.
"I don't," said Gabriel, "to be plain with you, friend, you don't carry in your countenance a letter of recommendation."
"It's not my wish," said the traveler. "My humor is to be avoided."
"Well," said the locksmith bluntly, "I think you'll have your humor."
"I will, at any cost," rejoined the traveler. "In proof of it, lay this to heart that you are never in such peril of your life as you have been within these few moments. When you are within 5 minutes of breathing your last, you will not be nearer death than you have been tonight."
"Aye," said the sturdy locksmith.
"Aye. And a violent death."
"From whose hand?"
"From mine," replied the traveler. With that he put spurs to his horse, and rode away, at first plashing heavily through the mire at a smart trot, but gradually increasing in speed until the last sound of his horse's hoofs died away upon the wind, when he was again hurrying on at the same furious gallop, which had been his pace when the locksmith first encountered him. Gabriel Varden remained standing in the road with the broken lantern in his hand, listening in stupefied silence until no sound reached his ear but the moaning of the wind, and the fast falling rain, when he struck himself one or two smart blows in the breast by way of rousing himself, and broke into an exclamation of surprise.
"What in the name of wonder can this fellow be? A madman? A highwayman? A cutthroat? If he had not scoured off so fast, we'd have seen who was in most danger, he or I. I never nearer death than I have been tonight. I hope I may be no nearer to it for a score of years to come. If so, I'll be content to be no farther from it. My stars! A pretty brag this to a stout man, pooh, pooh."
Gabriel resumed his seat, and looked wistfully up the road by which the traveler had come, murmuring in a half whisper. "The Maypole, 2 miles to the Maypole. I came the other road from the Warren after a long day's work at locks and bills, on purpose that I should not come by the Maypole and break my promise to Martha by looking in there's resolution. It would be dangerous to go on to London without a light, and it's 4 miles, and a good half mile besides, to the halfway house, and between this and that is the very place where one needs a light most. 2 miles to the Maypole. I told Martha I wouldn't, I said I wouldn't, and I didn't there's resolution." Repeating these two last words very often, as if to compensate for the little resolution he was going to show by piquing himself on the great resolution he had shown, Gabriel Varden quietly turned back, determining to get a light at the Maypole, and to take nothing but a light. When he got to the Maypole, however, and Joe, responding to his well-known hail, came running out to the horse's head, leaving the door open behind him, and disclosing a delicious perspective of warmth and brightness when the ruddy gleam of the fire, streaming through the old red curtains of the common room, seemed to bring with it, as part of itself, a pleasant hum of voices, and a fragrant odor of steaming grog and rare tobacco, all steeped as it were in the cheerful glow when the shadows, flitting across the curtain, showed that those inside had risen from their snug seats, and were making room in the snuggest corner. How well he knew that corner, for the honest locksmith, and a broad glare, suddenly streaming up, bespoke the goodness of the crackling log from which a brilliant train of sparks was doubtless at that moment whirling up the chimney in honor of his coming when, superadded to these enticements, there stole upon him from the distant kitchen a gentle sound of frying,
with a musical clatter of plates and dishes, and a savory smell that made even the boisterous wine to perfume Gabriel felt his firmness oozing rapidly away. He tried to look stoically at the tavern, but his features would relax into a look of fondness. He turned his head the other way, and the cold black country seemed to frown him off, and drive him for a refuge into its hospitable arms. "The merciful man, Joe," said the locksmith, "is merciful to his beast. I'll get out for a little while." And how natural it was to get out. And how unnatural it seemed for a sober man to be plodding wearily along through miry roads, encountering the rude buffets of the wind and pelting of the rain, when there was a clean floor covered with crisp white sand, a well-swept hearth, a blazing fire, a table decorated with white cloth, bright pewter flagons, and other tempting preparations for a well-cooked meal when there were these things, and company disposed to make the most of them, all ready to his hand, and entreating him to enjoyment. Chapter 3. Such were the locksmith's thoughts when first seated in the snug corner, and slowly recovering from a pleasant defect of vision pleasant, because occasioned by the wind blowing in his eyes, which made it a matter of sound policy and duty to himself, that he should take refuge from the weather, and tempted him, for the same reason, to aggravate a slight cough, and declare he felt but poorly. Such were still his thoughts more than a full hour afterwards, when, supper over, he still sat with shining jovial face in the same warm nook, listening to the cricket-like chirrup of little Solomon Daisy, and bearing no unimportant or slightly respected part in the social gossip round the maypole fire. "I wish he may be an honest man, that's all," said Solomon, winding up a variety of speculations relative to the stranger, concerning whom Gabriel had compared notes with the company, and so raised a grave discussion. "I wish he may be an honest man." "So we all do, I suppose, don't we?" observed the locksmith.
"I don't," said Joe.
"No," cried Gabriel. "No. He struck me with his whip, the coward, when he was mounted and I afoot, and I should be better pleased that he turned out what I think him."
"And what may that be, Joe?"
"No good, Mr. Varden. You may shake your head, father, but I say no good, and will say no good, and I would say no good 100 times over, if that would bring him back to have the drubbing he deserves."
"Hold your tongue, sir," said John Willet.
"I won't, father. It's all along of you that he ventured to do what he did. Seeing me treated like a child, and put down like a fool, he plucks up a heart and has a fling at a fellow that he thinks and may well think too hasn't a grain of spirit. But he's mistaken, as I'll show him, and as I'll show all of you before long."
"Does the boy know what he's a-saying of?" cried the astonished John Willet.
"Father," returned Joe, "I know what I say and mean, well better than you do when you hear me. I can bear with you, but I cannot bear the contempt that you're treating me in the way you do, brings upon me from others every day. Look at other young men of my age. Have they no liberty, no will, no right to speak? Are they obliged to sit mum chance, and to be ordered about till they are the laughing stock of young and old? I am a byword all over Chigwell, and I say, and it's fairer my saying so now, than waiting till you are dead, and I have got your money, I say, that before long I shall be driven to break such bounds, and that when I do, it won't be me that you'll have to blame, but your own self, and no other."
John Willet was so amazed by the exasperation and boldness of his hopeful son, that he sat as one bewildered, staring in a ludicrous manner at the boiler, and endeavoring, but quite ineffectually, to collect his tardy thoughts, and invent an answer. The guests, scarcely less disturbed, were equally at a loss, and at length, with a variety of muttered, half-expressed condolences, and pieces of advice, rose to depart, being at the same time slightly muddled with liquor. The honest locksmith alone addressed a few words of coherent and sensible advice to both parties, urging John Willet to remember that Joe was nearly arrived at man's estate, and should not be ruled with too tight a hand, and exhorting Joe himself to bear with his father's caprices, and rather endeavor to turn them aside by temperate remonstrance than by ill-timed rebellion. This advice was received as such advice usually is. On John Willet it made almost as much impression as on the sign outside the door, while Joe, who took it in the best part, avowed himself more obliged than he could well express, but politely intimated his intention nevertheless of taking his own course uninfluenced by anybody.
"You have always been a very good friend to me, Mr. Varden," he said, as they stood without, in the porch, and the locksmith was equipping himself for his journey home. "I take it very kind of you to say all this, but the time's nearly come when the maypole and I must part company."
"Roving stones gather no moss, Joe," said Gabriel.
"Nor milestones much," replied Joe. "I'm little better than one here, and see as much of the world."
"Then, what would you do, Joe?" pursued the locksmith, stroking his chin reflectively. "What could you be?"
Where could you go, you see? I must trust to chance, Mr. Varden.
A bad thing to trust to, Joe. I don't like it. I always tell my girl when we talk about a husband for her, never to trust to chance, but to make sure beforehand that she is a good man and true, and then chance will neither make her nor break her.
What are you fidgeting about there, Joe? Nothing gone in the harness, I hope?
No, no, said Joe, finding, however, something very engrossing to do in the way of strapping and buckling Miss Dolly quite well.
Hearty, thank I. She looks pretty enough to be well, and good too.
She's always both, sir.
So she is, thank God.
I hope, said Joe after some hesitation, that you won't tell this story against me, this of my having been beat like the boy they'd make of me at all events, till I have met this man again and settled the account. It'll be a better story then.
Why, who should I tell it to? Returned Gabriel. They know it here, and I'm not likely to come across anybody else who would care about it.
That's true enough, said the young fellow with a sigh. I quite forgot that.
Yes, that's true.
So saying, he raised his face, which was very red, no doubt from the exertion of strapping and buckling as aforesaid, and giving the reins to the old man, who had by this time taken his seat, sighed again and bade him good night.
Good night! Cried Gabriel.
Now think better of what we have just been speaking of, and don't be rash, there's a good fellow. I have an interest in you, and wouldn't have you cast yourself away. Good night!
Returning his cheery farewell with cordial goodwill, Joe Willett lingered until the sound of wheels ceased to vibrate in his ears, and then, shaking his head mournfully, re-entered the house. Gabriel Varden went his way towards London, thinking of a great many things, and most of all of flaming terms in which to relate his adventure, and so account satisfactorily to Mrs. Varden for visiting the Maypole, despite certain solemn covenants between himself and that lady. Thinking begets, not only thought, but drowsiness occasionally, and the more the locksmith thought, the more sleepy he became. A man may be very sober or at least firmly set upon his legs on that neutral ground which lies between the confines of perfect sobriety and slight tipsiness, and yet feel a strong tendency to mingle up present circumstances with others which have no manner of connection with them, to confound all consideration of persons, things, times, and places, and to jumble his disjointed thoughts together in a kind of mental kaleidoscope, producing combinations as unexpected as they are transitory. This was Gabriel Varden's state, as, nodding in his dog sleep, and leaving his horse to pursue a road with which he was well acquainted, he got over the ground unconsciously, and drew nearer and nearer home. He had roused himself once, when the horse stopped until the turnpike gate was opened, and had cried a lusty good night to the toll keeper, but then he awoke out of a dream about picking a lock in the stomach of the great mogul, and even when he did wake, mixed up the turnpike man with his mother-in-law who had been dead 20 years. It is not surprising, therefore, that he soon relapsed, and jogged heavily along, quite insensible to his progress. And, now, he approached the great city, which lay outstretched before him like a dark shadow on the ground, reddening the sluggish air with a deep dull light, that told of labyrinths of public ways and shops, and swarms of busy people. Approaching nearer and nearer yet, this halo began to fade, and the causes which produced it slowly to develop themselves. Long lines of poorly lighted streets might be faintly traced, with here and there a lighter spot, where lamps were clustered round a square or market, or round some great building. After a time these grew more distinct, and the lamps themselves were visible, slight yellow specks, that seemed to be rapidly snuffed out, one by one, as intervening obstacles hid them from the sight. Then, sounds arose: the striking of church clocks, the distant bark of dogs, the hum of traffic in the streets. Then outlines might be traced, tall steeples looming in the air, and piles of unequal roofs suppressed by chimneys. Then, the noise swelled into a louder sound, and forms grew more distinct and numerous still, and London visible in the darkness by its own faint light, and not by that of heaven, was at hand. The locksmith, however, all unconscious of its near vicinity, still jogged on, half sleeping and half waking, when a loud cry at no great distance ahead, roused him with a start. For a moment or two he looked about him like a man who had been transported to some strange country in his sleep, but soon recognizing familiar objects, rubbed his eyes lazily and might have relapsed again, but that the cry was repeated not once or twice or thrice, but many times, and each time, if possible, with increased vehemence. Thoroughly aroused, Gabriel, who was a bold man and not easily daunted, made straight to the spot, urging on his stout little horse as if for life or death. The matter indeed looked sufficiently serious, for, coming to the place whence the cries had proceeded,
He descried the figure of a man extended in an apparently lifeless state upon the pathway, and, hovering round him, another person with a torch in his hand, which he waved in the air with a wild impatience, redoubling meanwhile those cries for help which had brought the locksmith to the spot.
"What's here to do?" said the old man, alighting. "How's this what, Barnaby?"
The bearer of the torch shook his long loose hair back from his eyes, and thrusting his face eagerly into that of the locksmith, fixed upon him a look which told his history at once.
"You know me, Barnaby?" said Varden.
He nodded not once or twice, but a score of times, and that with a fantastic exaggeration which would have kept his head in motion for an hour, but that the locksmith held up his finger, and fixing his eye sternly upon him caused him to desist, then pointed to the body with an inquiring look.
"There's blood upon him," said Barnaby with a shudder. "It makes me sick."
"How came it there?" demanded Varden.
"Steel, steel, steel," he replied fiercely, imitating with his hand the thrust of a sword.
"Is he robbed?" said the locksmith. Barnaby caught him by the arm, and nodded yes, then pointed towards the city.
"Oh," said the old man, bending over the body and looking round as he spoke into Barnaby's pale face, strangely lighted up by something that was not intellect. "The robber made off that way, did he? Well, well, never mind that just now. Hold your torch this way a little farther off so. Now stand quiet, while I try to see what harm is done." With these words, he applied himself to a closer examination of the prostrate form, while Barnaby, holding the torch as he had been directed, looked on in silence, fascinated by interest or curiosity, but repelled nevertheless by some strong and secret horror which convulsed him in every nerve. As he stood, at that moment, half shrinking back and half bending forward, both his face and figure were full in the strong glare of the link, and as distinctly revealed as though it had been broad day. He was about 23 years old, and though rather spare, of a fair height and strong make. His hair, of which he had a great profusion, was red, and hanging in disorder about his face and shoulders, gave to his restless looks an expression quite unearthly, enhanced by the paleness of his complexion, and the glassy luster of his large protruding eyes. Startling as his aspect was, the features were good, and there was something even plaintive in his wan and haggard aspect. But, the absence of the soul is far more terrible in a living man than in a dead one, and in this unfortunate being its noblest powers were wanting. His dress was of green, clumsily trimmed here and there apparently by his own hands with gaudy lace, brightest where the cloth was most worn and soiled, and poorest where it was at the best. A pair of tawdry ruffles dangled at his wrists, while his throat was nearly bare. He had ornamented his hat with a cluster of peacock's feathers, but they were limp and broken, and now trailed negligently down his back. Girt to his side was the steel hilt of an old sword without blade or scabbard, and some pretty-colored ends of ribbons and poor glass toys completed the ornamental portion of his attire. The fluttered and confused disposition of all the motley scraps that formed his dress bespoke, in a scarcely less degree than his eager and unsettled manner, the disorder of his mind, and by a grotesque contrast set off and heightened the more impressive wildness of his face. "Barnaby," said the locksmith, after a hasty but careful inspection, "this man is not dead, but he has a wound in his side, and is in a fainting fit."
"I know him, I know him," cried Barnaby, clapping his hands.
"Know him?" repeated the locksmith.
"Hush," said Barnaby, laying his fingers upon his lips. "He went out today a wooing. I wouldn't for a light guinea that he should never go a wooing again, for, if he did, some eyes would grow dim that are now as bright as sea. When I talk of eyes, the stars come out. Whose eyes are they? If they are angels' eyes, why do they look down here and see good men hurt, and only wink and sparkle all the night?"
"Now heaven help this silly fellow," murmured the perplexed locksmith. "Can he know this gentleman? His mother's house is not far off. I had better see if she can tell me who he is. Barnaby, my man, help me to put him in the chaise, and we'll ride home together."
"I can't touch him," cried the idiot, falling back, and shuddering as with a strong spasm. "He's bloody."
"It's in his nature, I know," muttered the locksmith. "It's cruel to ask him, but I must have help. Barnaby, good Barnaby, dear Barnaby, if you know this gentleman, for the sake of his life and everybody's life that loves him, help me to raise him and lay him down."
"Cover him then. Wrap him close, don't let me see it, smell it, hear the word.
Don't speak the word, don't."
"No, no, I'll not. There, you see he's covered now. Gently. Well done, well done."
They placed him in the carriage with great ease, for Barnaby was strong and active, but all the time they were so occupied he shivered from head to foot, and evidently experienced an ecstasy of terror. This accomplished,
and the wounded man being covered with Vardhan's own greatcoat which he took off for the purpose, they proceeded onward at a brisk pace, Barnaby gaily counting the stars upon his fingers, and Gabriel inwardly congratulating himself upon having an adventure now, which would silence Mrs. Vardhan on the subject of the maypole, for that night, where there was no faith in woman. Chapter 4. In the venerable suburb, it was a suburb once of Clerkenwell, towards that part of its confines which is nearest to the Charter House, and in one of those cool, shady streets, of which a few, widely scattered and dispersed, yet remain in such old parts of the metropolis, each tenement quietly vegetating like an ancient citizen who long ago retired from business, and dozing on in its infirmity until in course of time it tumbles down, and is replaced by some extravagant young heir, flaunting in stucco and ornamental work, and all the vanities of modern days. In this quarter, and in a street of this description, the business of the present chapter lies. At the time of which it treats, though only 66 years ago, a very large part of what is London now had no existence. Even in the brains of the wildest speculators, there had sprung up no long rows of streets connecting Highgate with Whitechapel, no assemblages of palaces in the swampy levels, nor little cities in the open fields. Although this part of town was then, as now, parcelled out in streets, and plentifully peopled, it wore a different aspect. There were gardens to many of the houses, and trees by the pavement side, with an air of freshness breathing up and down, which in these days would be sought in vain. Fields were nigh at hand, through which the new river took its winding course, and where there was merry haymaking in the summer time. Nature was not so far removed, or hard to get at, as in these days, and although there were busy trades in Clerkenwell, and working jewellers by scores, it was a purer place, with farmhouses nearer to it than many modern Londoners would readily believe, and lovers' walks at no great distance, which turned into squalid courts, long before the lovers of this age were born, or, as the phrase goes, thought of. In one of these streets, the cleanest of them all, and on the shady side of the way, for good housewives know that sunlight damages their cherished furniture, and so choose the shade rather than its intrusive glare, there stood the house with which we have to deal. It was a modest building, not very straight, not large, not tall, not bold-faced, with great staring windows, but a shy, blinking house, with a conical roof going up into a peak over its garret window of 4 small panes of glass, like a cocked hat on the head of an elderly gentleman with one eye. It was not built of brick or lofty stone, but of wood and plaster. It was not planned with a dull and wearisome regard to regularity, for no one window matched the other, or seemed to have the slightest reference to anything besides itself. The shop for it had a shop was, with reference to the first floor, where shops usually are, and there all resemblance between it and any other shop stopped short and ceased. People who went in and out didn't go up a flight of steps to it, or walk easily in upon a level with the street, but dived down 3 steep stairs, as into a cellar. Its floor was paved with stone and brick, as that of any other cellar might be, and in lieu of window framed and glazed it had a great black wooden flap or shutter, nearly breast high from the ground, which turned back in the daytime, admitting as much cold air as light, and very often more. Behind this shop was a wainscoted parlour, looking first into a paved yard, and beyond that again into a little terrace garden, raised some feet above it. Any stranger would have supposed that this wainscoted parlour, saving for the door of communication by which he had entered, was cut off and detached from all the world, and indeed most strangers on their first entrance were observed to grow extremely thoughtful, as weighing and pondering in their minds whether the upper rooms were only approachable by ladders from without, never suspecting that 2 of the most unassuming and unlikely doors in existence, which the most ingenious mechanician on earth must of necessity have supposed to be the doors of closets, opened out of this room each without the smallest preparation, or so much as a quarter of an inch of passage upon 2 dark winding flights of stairs, the one upward, the other downward, which were the sole means of communication between that chamber and the other portions of the house. With all these oddities, there was not a neater, more scrupulously tidy, or more punctiliously ordered house, in Clerkenwell, in London, in all England. There were not cleaner windows, or whiter floors, or brighter stoves, or more highly shining articles of furniture in old mahogany. There was not more rubbing, scrubbing, burnishing and polishing, in the whole street put together. Nor was this excellence attained without some cost and trouble and great expenditure of voice, as the neighbors were frequently reminded when the good lady of the house overlooked and assisted in its being put to rights on cleaning days, which were usually from Monday morning till Saturday night, both days inclusive. Leaning against the doorpost of this, his dwelling, the locksmith stood early on the morning after he had met with the wounded man, gazing disconsolately at a great wooden emblem of a key, painted in vivid yellow to resemble gold, which dangled from the house front,
and swung to and fro with a mournful creaking noise, as if complaining that it had nothing to unlock. Sometimes, he looked over his shoulder into the shop, which was so dark and dingy with numerous tokens of his trade, and so blackened by the smoke of a little forge, near which his prentice was at work, that it would have been difficult for one unused to such espials to have distinguished anything but various tools of uncouth make and shape, great bunches of rusty keys, fragments of iron, half-finished locks, and such like things, which garnished the walls and hung in clusters from the ceiling. After a long and patient contemplation of the golden key, and many such backward glances, Gabriel stepped into the road, and stole a look at the upper windows. One of them chanced to be thrown open at the moment, and a roguish face met his, a face lighted up by the loveliest pair of sparkling eyes that ever locksmith looked upon, the face of a pretty, laughing, girl, dimpled and fresh, and healthful, the very impersonation of good humor and blooming beauty. "Hush," she whispered, bending forward and pointing archly to the window underneath. "Mother is still asleep." "Still, my dear," returned the locksmith in the same tone. "You talk as if she had been asleep all night, instead of little more than half an hour. But I'm very thankful. Sleep's a blessing, no doubt about it." The last few words he muttered to himself. "How cruel of you to keep us up so late this morning, and never tell us where you were, or send us word," said the girl. "Ah, Dolly, Dolly," returned the locksmith, shaking his head, and smiling, "how cruel of you to run upstairs to bed. Come down to breakfast, madcap, and come down lightly, or you'll wake your mother. She must be tired, I am sure I am." Keeping these latter words to himself, and returning his daughter's nod, he was passing into the workshop, with the smile she had awakened still beaming on his face, when he just caught sight of his prentice's brown paper cap ducking down to avoid observation, and shrinking from the window back to its former place, which the wearer no sooner reached than he began to hammer lustily. "Listening again, Simon," said Gabriel to himself. "That's bad. What in the name of wonder does he expect the girl to say, that I always catch him listening when she speaks, and never at any other time? A bad habit, Sim, a sneaking, underhanded way. Ah! You may hammer, but you won't beat that out of me, if you work at it till your time's up." So saying, and shaking his head gravely, he re-entered the workshop, and confronted the subject of these remarks. "There's enough of that just now," said the locksmith. "You needn't make any more of that confounded clatter. Breakfast's ready." "Sir," said Sim, looking up with amazing politeness, and a peculiar little bow cut short off at the neck, "I shall attend you immediately." "I suppose," muttered Gabriel, "that's out of the prentice's garland, or the prentice's delight, or the prentice's warbler, or the prentice's guide to the gallows, or some such improving textbook. Now he's going to beautify himself here as a precious locksmith." Quite unconscious that his master was looking on from the dark corner by the parlor door, Sim threw off the paper cap, sprang from his seat, and in two extraordinary steps, something between skating and minuet dancing, bounded to a washing place at the other end of the shop, and there removed from his face and hands all traces of his previous work, practicing the same step all the time with the utmost gravity. This done, he drew from some concealed place a little scrap of looking glass, and with its assistance arranged his hair, and ascertained the exact state of a little carbuncle in his nose. Having now completed his toilet, he placed the fragment of mirror on a low bench, and looked over his shoulder at so much of his legs as could be reflected in that small compass, with the greatest possible complacency and satisfaction. Sim, as he was called in the locksmith's family, or Mr. Simon Tapperty, as he called himself, and required all men to style him out of doors, on holidays, and Sundays out, was an old-fashioned, thin-faced, sleek-haired, sharp-nosed, small-eyed little fellow, very little more than 5 feet high, and thoroughly convinced in his own mind that he was above the middle size, rather tall, in fact, than otherwise. Of his figure, which was well enough formed, though somewhat of the leanest, he entertained the highest admiration, and with his legs, which, in knee breeches, were perfect curiosities of littleness, he was enraptured to a degree amounting to enthusiasm. He also had some majestic, shadowy ideas, which had never been quite fathomed by his intimate friends, concerning the power of his eye. Indeed, he had been known to go so far as to boast that he could utterly quell and subdue the haughtiest beauty by a simple process, which he termed eyeing her over, but it must be added, that neither of this faculty, nor of the power he claimed to have, through the same gift, of vanquishing and heaving down dumb animals, even in a rabid state, had he ever furnished evidence which could be deemed quite satisfactory and conclusive. It may be inferred from these premises, that in the small body of Mr. Tapperty there was locked up an ambitious and aspiring soul. As certain liquors,
confined in casks too cramped in their dimensions, will ferment, and fret, and chafe in their imprisonment, so the spiritual essence or soul of Mr. Tapperty would sometimes fume within that precious cask, his body, until, with great foam and froth and sputter, it would force a vent, and carry all before it. It was his custom to remark, in reference to any one of these occasions, that his soul had got into his head, and in this novel kind of intoxication many scrapes and mishaps befell him, which he had frequently concealed with no small difficulty from his worthy master. Sim Tapperty, among the other fancies upon which his before mentioned soul was forever feasting and regaling itself, and which fancies, like the liver of Prometheus, grew as they were fed upon, had a mighty notion of his order, and had been heard by the servant maid openly expressing his regret that the prentices no longer carried clubs wherewith to mace the citizens, that was his strong expression. He was likewise reported to have said that in former times a stigma had been cast upon the body by the execution of George Barnwell, to which they should not have basely submitted, but should have demanded him of the legislature temperately at first, then by an appeal to arms, if necessary to be dealt with as they in their wisdom might think fit. These thoughts always led him to consider what a glorious engine the prentices might yet become if they had but a master spirit at their head, and then he would darkly, and to the terror of his hearers, hint at certain reckless fellows that he knew of, and at a certain Lionheart ready to become their captain, who, once afoot, would make the Lord Mayor tremble on his throne. In respect of dress and personal decoration, Sim Tapperty was no less of an adventurous and enterprising character. He had been seen, beyond dispute, to pull off ruffles of the finest quality at the corner of the street on Sunday nights, and to put them carefully in his pocket before returning home, and it was quite notorious that on all great holiday occasions it was his habit to exchange his plain steel knee buckles for a pair of glittering paste, under cover of a friendly post, planted most conveniently in that same spot. Add to this that he was in years just 20, in his looks much older, and in conceit at least 200, that he had no objection to be jested with, touching his admiration of his master's daughter, and had even, when called upon at a certain obscure tavern to pledge the lady whom he honored with his love, toasted, with many winks and leers, a fair creature whose Christian name, he said, began with a D, and as much is known of Sim Tapperty, who has by this time followed the locksmith into breakfast, as is necessary to be known in making his acquaintance. It was a substantial meal, for, over and above the ordinary tea equipage, the board creaked beneath the weight of a jolly round of beef, a ham of the first magnitude, and sundry towers of buttered Yorkshire cake, piled slice upon slice in most alluring order. There was also a goodly jug of well-browned clay, fashioned into the form of an old gentleman, not by any means unlike the locksmith, atop of whose bald head was a fine white froth answering to his wig, indicative, beyond dispute, of sparkling home-brewed ale. But, better far than fair home-brewed, or Yorkshire cake, or ham, or beef, or anything to eat or drink that earth or air or water can supply, there sat, presiding over all, the locksmith's rosy daughter, before whose dark eyes even beef grew insignificant, and malt became as nothing. Fathers should never kiss their daughters when young men are by. It's too much. There are bounds to human endurance. So thought Sim Tapperty when Gabriel drew those rosy lips to his those lips within Sim's reach from day to day, and yet so far off. He had a respect for his master, but he wished the Yorkshire cake might choke him. "Father," said the locksmith's daughter, when this salute was over, and they took their seats at table, "what is this I hear about last night?" "All true, my dear, true as the gospel, doll. Young Mr. Chester robbed, and lying wounded in the road, when you came up. Eh, Mr. Edward? And beside him, Barnaby, calling for help with all his might. It was well it happened as it did, for the road's a lonely one, the hour was late, and, the night being cold, and poor Barnaby even less sensible than usual from surprise and fright, the young gentleman might have met his death in a very short time." "I dread to think of it," cried his daughter with a shudder. "How did you know him?"
"Know him?" returned the locksmith. "I didn't know him, how could I? I had never seen him, often as I had heard and spoken of him. I took him to Mrs. Rudge's, and she no sooner saw him than the truth came out. Miss Emma, father, if this news should reach her, enlarged upon as it is sure to be, she will go distracted.
Why, look high there again, how a man suffers for being good-natured," said the locksmith. Miss Emma was with her uncle at the masquerade at Carlisle House, where she had gone, as the people at the Warren told me, sorely against her will. "What does your blockhead father when he and Mrs. Rudge have laid their heads together, but goes there when he ought to be abed, makes interest with his friend the doorkeeper, slips him on a mask and domino, and mixes with the maskers?
And like himself to do so?" cried the girl, putting her fair arm round his neck,
and giving him a most enthusiastic kiss.
"Like himself," repeated Gabriel, affecting to grumble, but evidently delighted with the part he had taken, and with her praise.
"Very like himself, so your mother said." However, he mingled with the crowd, and prettily worried and badgered he was, "I warrant you, with people squeaking, don't you know me? And I've found you out," and all that kind of nonsense in his ears. He might have wondered until now, but in a little room there was a young lady who had taken off her mask, on account of the place being very warm, and was sitting there alone.
"And that was she?" said his daughter hastily.
"And that was she," replied the locksmith, and I no sooner whispered to her what the matter was as softly, "Doll," and with nearly as much art as you could have used yourself, than she gives a kind of scream and faints away.
"What did you do? What happened next?" asked his daughter.
"Why, the masks came flocking round, with a general noise and hubbub, and I thought myself in luck to get clear off, that's all," rejoined the locksmith. "What happened when I reached home you may guess, if you didn't hear it."
"Ah. Well, it's a poor heart that never rejoices. Put Toby this way, my dear." This Toby was the brown jug of which previous mention has been made. Applying his lips to the worthy old gentleman's benevolent forehead, the locksmith, who had all this time been ravaging among the eatables, kept them there so long, at the same time raising the vessel slowly in the air, that at length Toby stood on his head upon his nose, when he smacked his lips, and set him on the table again with fond reluctance. Although Sim Tappertit had taken no share in this conversation, no part of it being addressed to him, he had not been wanting in such silent manifestations of astonishment, as he deemed most compatible with a favorable display of his eyes. Regarding the pause which now ensued, as a particularly advantageous opportunity for doing great execution with him upon the locksmith's daughter, who he had no doubt was looking at him in mute admiration, he began to screw and twist his face, and especially those features, into such extraordinary, hideous, and unparalleled contortions, that Gabriel, who happened to look towards him, was stricken with amazement.
"Why, what the devil's the matter with the lad?" cried the locksmith. "Is he choking?"
"Who?" demanded Sim, with some disdain.
"Who? Why, you," returned his master. "What do you mean by making those horrible faces over your breakfast?"
"Faces are matters of taste, sir," said Mr. Tappertit, rather discomfited, not the less so because he saw the locksmith's daughter smiling.
"Sim," rejoined Gabriel, laughing heartily. "Don't be a fool, for I'd rather see you in your senses. These young fellows," he added, turning to his daughter, "are always committing some folly or another. There was a quarrel between Joe Willet and old John last night, though I can't say Joe was much in fault either. He'll be missing one of these mornings, and will have gone away upon some wild goose errand, seeking his fortune.
Why, what's the matter, doll? You are making faces now. The girls are as bad as the boys every bit."
"It's the tea," said Dolly, turning alternately very red and very white, "which is no doubt the effect of a slight scald so very hot." Mr. Tappertit looked immensely big at a quartern loaf on the table, and breathed hard.
"Is that all?" returned the locksmith. "Put some more milk in it."
"Yes, I am sorry for Joe, because he is a likely young fellow, and gains upon one every time one sees him. But he'll start off, you'll find. Indeed, he told me as much himself."
"Indeed?" cried Dolly in a faint voice. "Indeed. Is the tea tickling your throat still, my dear?" said the locksmith.
But, before his daughter could make him any answer, she was taken with a troublesome cough, and it was such a very unpleasant cough, that, when she left off, the tears were starting in her bright eyes. The good-natured locksmith was still patting her on the back and applying such gentle restoratives, when a message arrived from Mrs. Varden, making known to all whom it might concern, that she felt too much indisposed to rise after her great agitation and anxiety of the previous night, and therefore desired to be immediately accommodated with a little black teapot of strong mixed tea, a couple of rounds of buttered toast, a middling-sized dish of beef and ham cut thin, and the Protestant manual in two volumes post octavo. Like some other ladies who in remote ages flourished upon this globe, Mrs. Varden was most devout when most ill-tempered. Whenever she and her husband were at unusual variance, then the Protestant manual was in high feather. Knowing from experience what these requests portended, the triumvirate broke up: Dolly, to see the orders executed with all dispatch; Gabriel, to some out-of-door work in his little chaise; and Sim, to his daily duty in the workshop, to which retreat he carried the big look, although the loaf remained behind. Indeed, the big look increased immensely, and when he had tied his apron on, became quite gigantic. It was not until he had several times walked up and down with folded arms, and the longest strides he could take,
and had kicked a great many small articles out of his way, that his lip began to curl. At length, a gloomy derision came upon his features, and he smiled, uttering meanwhile with supreme contempt the monosyllable Joe. I eyed her over, while he talked about the fellow, he said, and that was of course the reason of her being confused. Joe. He walked up and down again much quicker than before, and if possible with longer strides, sometimes stopping to take a glance at his legs, and sometimes to jerk out, and cast from him, another Joe. In the course of a quarter of an hour or so he again assumed the paper cap and tried to work. No. It could not be done. I'll do nothing today, said Mr. Tapperty, dashing it down again, but grind. I'll grind up all the tools. Grinding will suit my present humor well. Joe. Whirrarrarrar. The grindstone was soon in motion, the sparks were flying off in showers. This was the occupation for his heated spirit. Whirrarrarrarrarrar. Something will come of this, said Mr. Tapperty, pausing as if in triumph, and wiping his heated face upon his sleeve. Something will come of this. I hope it mayn't be human gore. Whirrarrarrarrarrar. Chapter 5. As soon as the business of the day was over, the locksmith sallied forth, alone, to visit the wounded gentleman and ascertain the progress of his recovery. The house where he had left him was in Abbey Street in Southwark, not far from London Bridge, and thither he hied with all speed, bent upon returning with as little delay as might be, and getting to bed betimes. The evening was boisterous, scarcely better than the previous night had been. It was not easy for a stout man like Gabriel to keep his legs at the street corners, or to make head against the high wind, which often fairly got the better of him, and drove him back some paces, or, in defiance of all his energy, forced him to take shelter in an arch or doorway until the fury of the gust was spent. Occasionally a hat or wig, or both, came spinning and trundling past him, like a mad thing, while the more serious spectacle of falling tiles and slates, or of masses of brick and mortar or fragments of stone coping rattling upon the pavement near at hand, and splitting into fragments, did not increase the pleasure of the journey, or make the way less dreary. A trying night for a man like me to walk in, said the locksmith, as he knocked softly at the widow's door. I'd rather be in old John's chimney corner, faith. Who's there? Demanded a woman's voice from within. Being answered, it added a hasty word of welcome, and the door was quickly opened. She was about 40, perhaps 2 or 3 years older, with a cheerful aspect, and a face that had once been pretty. It bore traces of affliction and care, but they were of an old date, and time had smoothed them. Anyone who had bestowed but a casual glance on Barnaby might have known that this was his mother, from the strong resemblance between them, but where in his face there was wildness and vacancy, in hers there was the patient composure of long effort and quiet resignation. One thing about this face was very strange and startling. You could not look upon it in its most cheerful mood without feeling that it had some extraordinary capacity of expressing terror. It was not on the surface. It was in no one feature that it lingered. You could not take the eyes or mouth, or lines upon the cheek, and say, if this or that were otherwise, it would not be so. Yet there had always lurked something forever dimly seen, but ever there, and never absent for a moment. It was the faintest, palest shadow of some look, to which an instant of intense and most unutterable horror only could have given birth, but indistinct and feeble as it was, it did suggest what that look must have been, and fixed it in the mind as if it had had existence in a dream. More faintly imaged, and wanting force and purpose, as it were, because of his darkened intellect, there was this same stamp upon the sun. Seen in a picture, it must have had some legend with it, and would have haunted those who looked upon the canvas. They who knew the Maypole story, and could remember what the widow was, before her husband's and his master's murder, understood it well. They recollected how the change had come, and could call to mind that when her son was born, upon the very day the deed was known, he bore upon his wrist what seemed a smear of blood but half washed out. God save you, neighbor, said the locksmith, as he followed her, with the air of an old friend, into a little parlour where a cheerful fire was burning. And you, she answered smiling. Your kind heart has brought you here again. Nothing will keep you at home, I know of old, if there are friends to serve or comfort, out of doors. Tut, tut, returned the locksmith, rubbing his hands and warming them. You women are such talkers. What of the patient, neighbor? He is sleeping now. He was very restless towards daylight, and for some hours tossed and tumbled sadly. But the fever has left him, and the doctor says he will soon mend. He must not be removed until tomorrow. He has had visitors today, Humph? Said Gabriel, slyly. Yes. Old Mr. Chester has been here ever since we sent for him, and had not been gone many minutes when you knocked.
"No ladies?" said Gabriel, elevating his eyebrows and looking disappointed.
"A letter," replied the widow.
"Come. That's better than nothing," replied the locksmith.
"Who was the bearer?"
"Barnaby, of course."
"Barnaby's a jewel," said Vardin, "and comes and goes with ease where we who think ourselves much wiser would make but a poor hand of it. He is not out wandering, again, I hope?"
"Thank heaven he is in his bed, having been up all night, as you know, and on his feet all day. He was quite tired out.
Ah, neighbor, if I could but see him oftener, so if I could but tame down that terrible restlessness."
"In good time," said the locksmith, kindly, "in good time, don't be downhearted. To my mind he grows wiser every day."
The widow shook her head.
And yet, though she knew the locksmith sought to cheer her, and spoke from no conviction of his own, she was glad to hear even this praise of her poor benighted son.
"He will be a cute man yet," resumed the locksmith. "Take care, when we are growing old and foolish, Barnaby doesn't put us to the blush, that's all. But our other friend," he added, looking under the table and about the floor, "sharpest and cunningest of all the sharp and cunning ones, where's he?"
"In Barnaby's room," rejoined the widow, with a faint smile.
"Ah! He's a knowing blade," said Vardin, shaking his head. "I should be sorry to talk secrets before him.
Oh! He's a deep customer. I've no doubt he can read, and write, and cast accounts if he chooses.
What was that? Him tapping at the door?"
"No," returned the widow. "It was in the street, I think. Hark! Yes! There again! 'Tis someone knocking softly at the shutter. Who can it be?"
They had been speaking in a low tone, for the invalid lay overhead, and the walls and ceilings being thin and poorly built, the sound of their voices might otherwise have disturbed his slumber. The party without, whoever it was, could have stood close to the shutter without hearing anything spoken, and, seeing the light through the chinks and finding all so quiet, might have been persuaded that only one person was there.
"Some thief or ruffian maybe," said the locksmith. "Give me the light."
"No, no," she returned hastily. "Such visitors have never come to this poor dwelling. Do you stay here? You're within call, at the worst. I would rather go myself alone."
"Why?" said the locksmith, unwillingly relinquishing the candle he had caught up from the table.
"Because I don't know why, because the wish is so strong upon me," she rejoined. "There again, do not detain me, I beg of you."
Gabriel looked at her, in great surprise to see one who was usually so mild and quiet thus agitated, and with so little cause. She left the room and closed the door behind her. She stood for a moment as if hesitating, with her hand upon the lock. In this short interval the knocking came again, and a voice close to the window, a voice the locksmith seemed to recollect, and to have some disagreeable association with, whispered, "Make haste." The words were uttered in that low distinct voice which finds its way so readily to sleepers' ears, and wakes them in a fright. For a moment it startled even the locksmith, who involuntarily drew back from the window, and listened. The wind rumbling in the chimney made it difficult to hear what passed, but he could tell that the door was opened, that there was the tread of a man upon the creaking boards, and then a moment's silence broken by a suppressed something which was not a shriek, or groan, or cry for help, and yet might have been either or all three, and the words, "My God!" uttered in a voice it chilled him to hear. He rushed out upon the instant. There, at last, was that dreadful look, the very one he seemed to know so well and yet had never seen before, upon her face. There she stood, frozen to the ground, gazing with starting eyes, and livid cheeks, and every feature fixed and ghastly, upon the man he had encountered in the dark last night. His eyes met those of the locksmith. It was but a flash, an instant, a breath upon a polished glass, and he was gone. The locksmith was upon him, had the skirts of his streaming garment almost in his grasp when his arms were tightly clutched, and the widow flung herself upon the ground before him. "The other way, the other way," she cried. "He went the other way. Turn, turn."
"The other way. I see him now," rejoined the locksmith, pointing yonder. There is his shadow passing by that light. "What, who is this? Let me go."
"Come back, come back," exclaimed the woman, clasping him. "Do not touch him on your life. I charge you, come back. He carries other lives besides his own. Come back."
"What does this mean?" cried the locksmith.
"No matter what it means, don't ask, don't speak, don't think about it. He is not to be followed, checked, or stopped. Come back."
The old man looked at her in wonder, as she writhed and clung about him, and, borne down by her passion, suffered her to drag him into the house. It was not until she had chained and double-locked the door, fastened every bolt and bar with the heat and fury of a maniac, and drawn him back into the room, that she turned upon him, once again, that stony look of horror, and, sinking down into a chair, covered her face, and shuddered, as though the hand of death were on her. Chapter 6. Beyond all measure astonished by the strange occurrences which had passed with so much violence and rapidity, the locksmith gazed upon the shuddering figure in the chair like one half stupefied, and would have gazed much longer, had not his tongue been loosened by compassion and humanity. "You are ill," said Gabriel. "Let me call some neighbor in." "Not for the world," she rejoined, motioning to him with her trembling hand, and holding her face averted. "It is enough that you have been by, to see this."
"Nay, more than enough or less," said Gabriel.
"Be it so," she returned. "As you like. Ask me no questions, I entreat you."
"Neighbor," said the locksmith, after a pause, "is this fair, or reasonable, or just to yourself? Is it like you, who have known me so long and sought my advice in all matters, like you, who from a girl have had a strong mind and a staunch heart?"
"I have need of them," she replied. "I am growing old, both in years and care. Perhaps that, and too much trial, have made them weaker than they used to be. Do not speak to me."
"How can I see what I have seen, and hold my peace?" returned the locksmith. "Who is that man, and why has his coming made this change in you?"
She was silent, but held to the chair as though to save herself from falling on the ground.
"I take the license of an old acquaintance, Mary," said the locksmith, "who has ever had a warm regard for you, and maybe has tried to prove it when he could. Who is this ill-favored man, and what has he to do with you? Who is this ghost, that is only seen in the black nights and bad weather? How does he know, and why does he haunt this house, whispering through chinks and crevices, as if there was that between him and you, which neither durst so much as speak aloud of? Who is he?"
"You do well to say he haunts this house," returned the widow, faintly. "His shadow has been upon it and me, in light and darkness, at noonday and midnight. And now, at last, he has come in the body."
"But he wouldn't have got in the body," returned the locksmith with some irritation, "if you had left my arms and legs at liberty. What riddle is this?"
"It is one," she answered, rising as she spoke, "that must remain forever as it is. I dare not say more than that."
"Dare not?" repeated the wondering locksmith.
"Do not press me," she replied. "I am sick and faint, and every faculty of life seems dead within me. No. Do not touch me, either."
Gabriel, who had stepped forward to render her assistance, fell back as she made this hasty exclamation, and regarded her in silent wonder.
"Let me go my way alone," she said in a low voice, "and let the hands of no honest man touch mine tonight." When she had tottered to the door, she turned, and added with a stronger effort, "This is a secret, which, of necessity, I trust to you. You are a true man. As you have ever been good and kind to me, keep it. If any noise was heard above, make some excuse, say anything but what you really saw, and never let a word or a look between us recall this circumstance. I trust to you. Mind, I trust to you. How much I trust, you never can conceive."
Casting her eyes upon him for an instant, she withdrew, and left him there alone. Gabriel, not knowing what to think, stood staring at the door with a countenance full of surprise and dismay. The more he pondered on what had passed, the less able he was to give it any favorable interpretation. To find this widow woman, whose life for so many years had been supposed to be one of solitude and retirement, and who, in her quiet suffering character, had gained the good opinion and respect of all who knew her, to find her linked mysteriously with an ill-omened man, alarmed at his appearance, and yet favoring his escape, was a discovery that pained as much as startled him. Her reliance on his secrecy, and his tacit acquiescence, increased his distress of mind. If he had spoken boldly, persisted in questioning her, detained her when she rose to leave the room, made any kind of protest, instead of silently compromising himself, as he felt he had done, he would have been more at ease.
"Why did I let her say it was a secret, and she trusted it to me?" said Gabriel, putting his wig on one side to scratch his head with greater ease, and looking ruefully at the fire. "I have no more readiness than old John himself. Why didn't I say firmly, 'You have no right to such secrets, and I demand of you to tell me what this means,' instead of standing gaping at her, like an old moon calf as I am? But there's my weakness. I can be obstinate enough with men if need be, but women may twist me round their fingers at their pleasure." He took his wig off outright as he made this reflection, and, warming his handkerchief at the fire, began to rub and polish his bald head with it, until it glistened again. "And yet," said the locksmith, softening under this soothing process, and stopping to smile, "it may be nothing. Any drunken brawler trying to make his way into the house would have alarmed a quiet soul like her. But then and here was the vexation. How came it to be that man? How comes he to have this influence over her? How came she to favor his getting away from me? And, more than all, how came she not to say it was a sudden fright, and nothing more? It's a sad thing to have, in one minute, reason to mistrust a person I have known so long, and an old sweetheart into the bargain, but what else can I do, with all this upon my mind? Is that Barnaby outside there?
Eh? He cried, looking in and nodding. Sure enough, it's Barnaby. How did you guess?
By your shadow, said the locksmith.
Oh, cried Barnaby, glancing over his shoulder, he's a merry fellow, that shadow, and keeps close to me, though I am silly. We have such pranks, such walks, such runs, such gambols on the grass. Sometimes he'll be half as tall as a church steeple, and sometimes no bigger than a dwarf. Now, he goes on before, and now behind, and anon he'll be stealing on this side, or on that, stopping whenever I stop, and thinking I can't see him, though I have my eye on him sharp enough. Oh! He's a merry fellow. Tell me, is he silly too?
I think he is.
Why? Asked Gabriel.
Because he never tires of mocking me, but does it all day long. Why don't you come?
Where?
Upstairs. He wants you. Stay where's his shadow? Come. You're a wise man, tell me that.
Beside him, Barnaby, beside him, I suppose, returned the locksmith.
No. He replied, shaking his head. Guess again.
Gone out a walking, maybe?
He has changed shadows with a woman, the idiot whispered in his ear, and then fell back with a look of triumph. Her shadow's always with him, and his with her. That's sport, I think, eh?
Barnaby, said the locksmith, with a grave look, come hither, lad.
I know what you want to say.
I know. He replied, keeping away from him. But I'm cunning, I'm silent. I only say so much to you, are you ready? As he spoke, he caught up the light, and waved it with a wild laugh above his head.
Softly, gently, said the locksmith, exerting all his influence to keep him calm and quiet. I thought you had been asleep.
So I have been asleep, he rejoined, with widely opened eyes. There have been great faces coming and going close to my face, and then a mile away low places to creep through, whether I would or no, high churches to fall down from, strange creatures crowded up together neck and heels, to sit upon the bed that sleep, eh?
Dreams, Barnaby, dreams, said the locksmith.
Dreams, he echoed softly, drawing closer to him. Those are not dreams.
What are, replied the locksmith, if they are not?
I dreamed, said Barnaby, passing his arm through Varden's, and peering close into his face as he answered in a whisper, I dreamed just now that something, it was in the shape of a man, followed me, came softly after me, wouldn't let me be, but was always hiding and crouching, like a cat in dark corners, waiting till I should pass, when it crept out and came softly after me.
Did you ever see me run?
Many a time, you know.
You never saw me run as I did in this dream. Still it came creeping on to worry me. Nearer, nearer, nearer I ran, faster leapt, sprung out of bed, and to the window, and there, in the street below, but he is waiting for us.
Are you coming?
What in the street below, Barnaby? Said Varden, imagining that he traced some connection between this vision and what had actually occurred.
Barnaby looked into his face, muttered incoherently, waved the light above his head again, laughed, and drawing the locksmith's arm more tightly through his own, led him up the stairs in silence. They entered a homely bedchamber, garnished in a scanty way with chairs, whose spindle shanks bespoke their age, and other furniture of very little worth, but clean and neatly kept. Reclining in an easy chair before the fire, pale and weak from waste of blood, was Edward Chester, the young gentleman who had been the first to quit the Maypole on the previous night, and who, extending his hand to the locksmith, welcomed him as his preserver and friend.
Say no more, sir, say no more, said Gabriel. I hope I would have done at least as much for any man in such a strait, and most of all for you, sir.
A certain young lady, he added, with some hesitation, has done us many a kind turn, and we naturally feel, I hope I give you no offense in saying this, sir?
The young man smiled and shook his head, at the same time moving in his chair as if in pain.
It's no great matter, he said, in answer to the locksmith's sympathizing look, a mere uneasiness arising at least as much from being cooped up here, as from the slight wound I have, or from the loss of blood.
Be seated, Mr. Varden.
If I may make so bold, Mr. Edward, as to lean upon your chair, returned the locksmith, accommodating his action to his speech, and bending over him, I'll stand here for the convenience of speaking low. Barnaby is not in his quietest humor tonight,
and at such times talking never does him good. They both glanced at the subject of this remark, who had taken a seat on the other side of the fire, and, smiling vacantly, was making puzzles on his fingers with a skein of string.
"Pray, tell me, sir," said Vardhan, dropping his voice still lower, "exactly what happened last night? I have my reason for inquiring.
You left the Maypole, alone?
And walked homeward alone, until I had nearly reached the place where you found me, when I heard the gallop of a horse.
Behind you?" said the locksmith.
"Indeed, yes, behind me. It was a single rider, who soon overtook me, and checking his horse, inquired the way to London.
You were on the alert, sir, knowing how many highwaymen there are, scouring the roads in all directions?" said Vardhan.
"I was, but I had only a stick, having imprudently left my pistols in their holster case with the landlord's son. I directed him as he desired. Before the words had passed my lips, he rode upon me furiously, as if bent on trampling me down beneath his horse's hoofs. In starting aside, I slipped and fell. You found me with this stab and an ugly bruise or two, and without my purse, in which he found little enough for his pains. And now, Mr. Vardhan," he added, shaking the locksmith by the hand, "saving the extent of my gratitude to you, you know as much as I."
"Except," said Gabriel, bending down yet more, and looking cautiously towards their silent Nayauer, "except in respect of the robber himself."
"What like was he, sir?"
"Speak low, if you please. Barnaby means no harm, but I've watched him oftener than you, and I know, little as you would think it, that he's listening now."
It required a strong confidence in the locksmith's veracity to lead anyone to this belief, for every sense and faculty that Barnaby possessed seemed to be fixed upon his game, to the exclusion of all other things. Something in the young man's face expressed this opinion, for Gabriel repeated what he had just said, more earnestly than before, and with another glance towards Barnaby, again asked what like the man was.
"The night was so dark," said Edward, "the attack so sudden, and he so wrapped and muffled up, that I can hardly say. It seems that—"
"Don't mention his name, sir," returned the locksmith, following his look towards Barnaby, "I know he saw him. I want to know what you saw."
"All I remember is," said Edward, "that as he checked his horse his hat was blown off. He caught it, and replaced it on his head, which I observed was bound with a dark handkerchief. A stranger entered the Maypole while I was there, whom I had not seen, for I had sat apart for reasons of my own, and when I rose to leave the room and glanced round, he was in the shadow of the chimney and hidden from my sight. But, if he and the robber were two different persons, their voices were strangely and most remarkably alike, for directly the man addressed me in the road, I recognized his speech again.
It is as I feared. The very man was here tonight," thought the locksmith, changing color. "What dark history is this?"
"Halloa!" cried a hoarse voice in his ear.
"Halloa, halloa, halloa.
Bow wow wow. What's the matter here?
Halloa!"
The speaker, who made the locksmith start as if he had been some supernatural agent, was a large raven, who had perched upon the top of the easy chair, unseen by him and Edward, and listened with a polite attention and a most extraordinary appearance of comprehending every word to all they had said up to this point, turning his head from one to the other, as if his office were to judge between them, and it were of the very last importance that he should not lose a word.
"Look at him," said Vardhan, divided between admiration of the bird and a kind of fear of him. "Was there ever such a knowing imp as that? Oh, he's a dreadful fellow."
The raven, with his head very much on one side, and his bright eye shining like a diamond, preserved a thoughtful silence for a few seconds, and then replied in a voice so hoarse and distant, that it seemed to come through his thick feathers rather than out of his mouth.
"Halloa, halloa, halloa. What's the matter here?
Keep up your spirits. Never say die. Bow wow wow. I'm a devil, I'm a devil, I'm a devil. Hurrah!" exclamation mark, and then, as if exulting in his infernal character, he began to whistle.
"I more than half believe he speaks the truth. Upon my word I do," said Vardhan. "Do you see how he looks at me, as if he knew what I was saying?"
To which the bird, balancing himself on tiptoe, as it were, and moving his body up and down in a sort of grave dance, rejoined, "I'm a devil, I'm a devil, I'm a devil," and flapped his wings against his sides as if he were bursting with laughter. Barnaby clapped his hands, and fairly rolled upon the ground in an ecstasy of delight.
"Strange companions, sir," said the locksmith, shaking his head, and looking from one to the other. "The bird has all the wit."
"Strange indeed," said Edward, holding out his forefinger to the raven, who, in acknowledgement of the attention, made a dive at it immediately with his iron bill.
"Is he old?"
"A mere boy, sir," replied the locksmith. 120, or thereabouts. Call him down, Barnaby, my man.
Call him," echoed Barnaby, sitting upright upon the floor, and staring vacantly at Gabriel, as he thrust his hair back from his face. But who can make him come? He calls me, and makes me go where he will. He goes on before, and I follow. He's the master, and I'm the man. Is that the truth, Grip?" The raven gave a short, comfortable, confidential kind of croak, a most expressive croak, which seemed to say, "You needn't let these fellows into our secrets. We understand each other. It's all right."
"I make him come?" cried Barnaby, pointing to the bird. "Him, who never goes to sleep, or so much as winks. Why, any time of night, you may see his eyes in my dark room, shining like two sparks. And every night, and all night too, he's broad awake, talking to himself, thinking what he shall do tomorrow, where we shall go, and what he shall steal, and hide, and bury. I make him come. Ha ha ha." On second thoughts, the bird appeared disposed to come of himself. After a short survey of the ground, and a few sidelong looks at the ceiling and at everybody present in turn, he fluttered to the floor, and went to Barnaby not in a hop, or walk, or run, but in a pace like that of a very particular gentleman with exceedingly tight boots on, trying to walk fast over loose pebbles. Then, stepping into his extended hand, and condescending to be held out at arm's length, he gave vent to a succession of sounds, not unlike the drawing of some 8 or 10 dozen of long corks, and again asserted his brimstone birth and parentage with great distinctness. The locksmith shook his head, perhaps in some doubt of the creature's being really nothing but a bird, perhaps in pity for Barnaby, who by this time had him in his arms, and was rolling about, with him, on the ground. As he raised his eyes from the poor fellow, he encountered those of his mother, who had entered the room, and was looking on in silence. She was quite white in the face, even to her lips, but had wholly subdued her emotion, and wore her usual quiet look. Vardhan fancied as he glanced at her that she shrunk from his eye, and that she busied herself about the wounded gentleman to avoid him the better. It was time he went to bed, she said. He was to be removed to his own home on the morrow, and he had already exceeded his time for sitting up, by a full hour. Acting on this hint, the locksmith prepared to take his leave. "By the by," said Edward, as he shook him by the hand, and looked from him to Mrs. Rudge and back again, "what noise was that below? I heard your voice in the midst of it, and should have inquired before, but our other conversation drove it from my memory. What was it?" The locksmith looked towards her, and bit his lip. She leaned against the chair, and bent her eyes upon the ground. Barnaby too he was listening. "Some mad or drunken fellow, sir," Vardhan at length made answer, looking steadily at the widow as he spoke. "He mistook the house, and tried to force an entrance." She breathed more freely, but stood quite motionless. As the locksmith said goodnight, and Barnaby caught up the candle to light him down the stairs, she took it from him, and charged him with more haste and earnestness than so slight an occasion appeared to warrant not to stir. The raven followed them to satisfy himself that all was right below, and when they reached the street door, stood on the bottom stair drawing corks out of number. With a trembling hand she unfastened the chain and bolts, and turned the key. As she had her hand upon the latch, the locksmith said in a low voice, "I have told a lie tonight, for your sake, Mary, and for the sake of bygone times and old acquaintance, when I would scorn to do so for my own. I hope I may have done no harm, or led to none. I can't help the suspicions you have forced upon me, and I am loath, I tell you plainly, to leave Mr. Edward here. Take care he comes to no hurt. I doubt the safety of this roof, and am glad he leaves it so soon. Now, let me go." For a moment she hid her face in her hands and wept, but resisting the strong impulse which evidently moved her to reply, opened the door no wider than was sufficient for the passage of his body and motioned him away. As the locksmith stood upon the step, it was chained and locked behind him, and the raven, in furtherance of these precautions, barked like a lusty house dog. In league with that ill-looking figure that might have fallen from a gibbet, he listening and hiding here Barnaby first upon the spot last night, can she who has always borne so fair a name be guilty of such crimes in secret? Said the locksmith, musing. Heaven forgive me if I am wrong, and send me just thoughts, but she is poor, the temptation may be great, and we daily hear of things as strange. Eh, bark away, my friend. If there's any wickedness going on, that raven's in it, I'll be sworn. Chapter 7. Mrs. Vardhan was a lady of what is commonly called an uncertain temper, a phrase which being interpreted signifies a temper tolerably certain to make everybody more or less uncomfortable. Thus it generally happened, that when other people were merry, Mrs. Vardhan was dull, and that when other people were dull, Mrs. Varden was disposed to be amazingly cheerful. Indeed, the worthy housewife was of such a capricious nature that she not only attained a higher pitch of genius than Macbeth, in respect of her ability to be wise, amazed, temperate and furious, loyal and neutral in an instant, but would sometimes ring the changes backwards and forwards on all possible moods and flights in one short quarter of an hour, performing, as it were, a kind of triple bob major on the peal of instruments in the female belfry, with a skillfulness and rapidity of execution that astonished all who heard her. It had been observed in this good lady, who did not want for personal attractions, being plump and buxom to look at, though like her fair daughter, somewhat short in stature, that this uncertainty of disposition strengthened and increased with her temporal prosperity, and divers wise men and matrons, on friendly terms with the locksmith and his family, even went so far as to assert that a tumble down some half dozen rounds in the world's ladder, such as the breaking of the bank in which her husband kept his money, or some little fall of that kind would be the making of her, and could hardly fail to render her one of the most agreeable companions in existence. Whether they were right or wrong in this conjecture, certain it is that minds, like bodies, will often fall into a pimpled ill-conditioned state from mere excess of comfort, and like them, are often successfully cured by remedies in themselves very nauseous and unpalatable. Mrs. Varden's chief aider and abettor, and at the same time her principal victim and object of wrath, was her single domestic servant, one Miss Miggs, or as she was called, in conformity with those prejudices of society which lop and top from poor handmaidens all such genteel excrescences Miggs. This Miggs was a tall young lady, very much addicted to pattens in private life, slender and shrewish, of a rather uncomfortable figure, and though not absolutely ill-looking, of a sharp and acid visage. As a general principle and abstract proposition, Miggs held the male sex to be utterly contemptible and unworthy of notice, to be fickle, false, base, sottish, inclined to perjury, and wholly undeserving. When particularly exasperated against them, which, scandal said, was when some tapper tea slighted her most, she was accustomed to wish with great emphasis that the whole race of women could but die off, in order that the men might be brought to know the real value of the blessings by which they set so little store. Nay, her feeling for her order ran so high, that she sometimes declared, if she could only have good security for a fair, round number say 10,000 of young virgins following her example, she would, to spite mankind, hang, drown, stab, or poison herself, with a joy past all expression. It was the voice of Miggs that greeted the locksmith, when he knocked at his own house, with a shrill cry of "Who's there?" "Me, girl, me," returned Gabriel. "What, already, sir?" said Miggs, opening the door with a look of surprise. "We were just getting on our nightcaps to sit up, me and mistress. Oh, she has been so bad." Miggs said this with an air of uncommon candor and concern, but the parlor door was standing open, and as Gabriel very well knew for whose ears it was designed, he regarded her with anything but an approving look as he passed in. "Master's come home, M.I.M.," cried Miggs, running before him into the parlor. "You was wrong, M.I.M., and I was right. I thought he wouldn't keep us up so late, two nights running, M.I.M. Master's always considerate so far. I'm so glad, M.I.M., on your account. I'm a little here," Miggs simpered, "a little sleepy myself, I'll own it now, M.I.M., though I said I wasn't when you asked me. It ain't of no consequence, M.I.M., of course." "You had better," said the locksmith, who most devoutly wished that Barnaby's raven was at Miggs's ankles, "you had better get to bed at once then." "Thanking you kindly, sir," returned Miggs, "I couldn't take my rest in peace, nor fix my thoughts upon my prayers, otherwise than that I knew mistress was comfortable in her bed this night. By rights she ought to have been there, hours ago." "You were talkative, mistress," said Varden, pulling off his greatcoat, and looking at her askew. "Taking the hint, sir," cried Miggs, with a flushed face, "and thanking you for it most kindly, I will make bold to say, that if I give offense by having consideration for my mistress, I do not ask your pardon, but am content to get myself into trouble and to be in suffering." Here Mrs. Varden, who, with her countenance shrouded in a large nightcap, had been all this time intent upon the Protestant manual, looked round, and acknowledged Miggs's championship by commanding her to hold her tongue. Every little bone in Miggs's throat and neck developed itself with a spitefulness quite alarming, as she replied, "Yes, M.I.M., I will." "How do you find yourself now, my dear?" said the locksmith, taking a chair near his wife, who had resumed her book, and rubbing his knees hard as he made the inquiry. "You were very anxious to know, ain't you?" returned Mrs. Varden, with her eyes upon the print. "You, that have not been near me all day, and wouldn't have been if I was dying."
My dear Martha, said Gabriel. Mrs. Varden turned over to the next page, then went back again to the bottom line over leaf to be quite sure of the last words, and then went on reading with an appearance of the deepest interest and study. My dear Martha, said the locksmith, how can you say such things, when you know you don't mean them? If you were dying. Why, if there was anything serious the matter with you, Martha, shouldn't I be in constant attendance upon you? Yes, cried Mrs. Varden, bursting into tears, yes, you would. I don't doubt it, Varden. Certainly you would. That's as much as to tell me that you would be hovering round me like a vulture, waiting till the breath was out of my body, that you might go and marry somebody else. Miggs groaned in sympathy, a little short groan, checked in its birth, and changed into a cough. It seemed to say, I can't help it. It's wrung from me by the dreadful brutality of that monster master. But you'll break my heart one of these days, added Mrs. Varden, with more resignation, and then we shall both be happy. My only desire is to see Dolly comfortably settled, and when she is, you may settle me as soon as you like. Ah! Cried Miggs and coughed again. Poor Gabriel twisted his wig about in silence for a long time, and then said mildly, has Dolly gone to bed? Your master speaks to you, said Mrs. Varden, looking sternly over her shoulder at Miss Miggs in waiting. No, my dear, I spoke to you, suggested the locksmith. Did you hear me, Miggs? Cried the obdurate lady, stamping her foot upon the ground. You are beginning to despise me now, are you? But this is example. At this cruel rebuke, Miggs, whose tears were always ready, for large or small parties, on the shortest notice and the most reasonable terms, fell a-crying violently, holding both her hands tight upon her heart meanwhile, as if nothing less would prevent its splitting into small fragments. Mrs. Varden, who likewise possessed that faculty in high perfection, wept too, against Miggs, and with such effect that Miggs gave in after a time, and, except for an occasional sob, which seemed to threaten some remote intention of breaking out again, left her mistress in possession of the field. Her superiority being thoroughly asserted, that lady soon desisted likewise, and fell into a quiet melancholy. The relief was so great, and the fatiguing occurrences of last night so completely overpowered the locksmith, that he nodded in his chair, and would doubtless have slept there all night, but for the voice of Mrs. Varden, which, after a pause of some 5 minutes, awoke him with a start. If I am ever, said Mrs. V. Not scolding, but in a sort of monotonous remonstrance in spirits, if I am ever cheerful, if I am ever more than usually disposed to be talkative and comfortable, this is the way I am treated. Such spirits as you was in too, am, but half an hour ago, cried Miggs. I never see such company. Because, said Mrs. Varden, because I never interfere or interrupt, because I never question where anybody comes or goes, because my whole mind and soul is bent on saving where I can save, and laboring in this house, therefore, they try me as they do. Martha, urged the locksmith, endeavoring to look as wakeful as possible, what is it you complain of? I really came home with every wish and desire to be happy. I did, indeed. What do I complain of? Retorted his wife. Is it a chilling thing to have one's husband sulking and falling asleep directly he comes home to have him freezing all one's warm-heartedness, and throwing cold water over the fireside? Is it natural, when I know he went out upon a matter in which I am as much interested as anybody can be, that I should wish to know all that has happened, or that he should tell me without my begging and praying him to do it? Is that natural, or is it not? I am very sorry, Martha, said the good-natured locksmith. I was really afraid you were not disposed to talk pleasantly. I'll tell you everything, I shall only be too glad, my dear. No, Varden, returned his wife, rising with dignity. I dare say thank you. I'm not a child to be corrected one minute and petted the next time a little too old for that, Varden. Miggs, carry the light. You can be cheerful, Miggs, at least. Miggs, who, to this moment, had been in the very depths of compassionate despondency, passed instantly into the liveliest state conceivable, and tossing her head as she glanced towards the locksmith, bore off her mistress and the light together. Now, who would think, thought Varden, shrugging his shoulders and drawing his chair nearer to the fire, that that woman could ever be pleasant and agreeable. And yet she can be. Well, well, all of us have our faults. I'll not be hard upon hers. We have been man and wife too long for that. He dozed again, not the less pleasantly, perhaps, for his hearty temper. While his eyes were closed, the door leading to the upper stairs was partially opened, and a head appeared, which, at sight of him, hastily drew back again. I wish, murmured Gabriel, waking at the noise, and looking round the room,
I wish somebody would marry Migs. But that's impossible. I wonder whether there's any madman alive who would marry Migs. This was such a vast speculation that he fell into a doze again, and slept until the fire was quite burned out. At last he roused himself, and having double-locked the street door according to custom, and put the key in his pocket, went off to bed. He had not left the room in darkness many minutes, when the head again appeared, and Sim Tapperty entered, bearing in his hand a little lamp. "What the devil business has he to stop up so late?" muttered Sim, passing into the workshop, and setting it down upon the forge. "Here's half the night gone already. There's only one good that has ever come to me, out of this cursed old rusty mechanical trade, and that's this piece of ironmongery, upon my soul." As he spoke, he drew from the right hand, or rather right leg pocket of his smalls, a clumsy large-sized key, which he inserted cautiously in the lock his master had secured, and softly opened the door. That done, he replaced his piece of secret workmanship in his pocket, and leaving the lamp burning, and closing the door carefully and without noise, stole out into the street as little suspected by the locksmith in his sound deep sleep, as by Barnaby himself in his phantom-haunted dreams. Chapter 8. Clear of the locksmith's house, Sim Tapperty laid aside his cautious manner, and assuming in its stead that of a ruffling, swaggering, roving blade, who would rather kill a man than otherwise, and eat him too if needful, made the best of his way along the darkened streets. Half pausing for an instant now and then to smite his pocket and assure himself of the safety of his master key, he hurried on to Barbican, and turning into one of the narrowest of the narrow streets which diverged from that center, slackened his pace and wiped his heated brow, as if the termination of his walk were near at hand. It was not a very choice spot for midnight expeditions, being in truth one of more than questionable character, and of an appearance by no means inviting. From the main street he had entered, itself little better than an alley, a low-browed doorway led into a blind court, or yard, profoundly dark, unpaved, and reeking with stagnant odors. Into this ill-favored pit, the locksmith's vagrant prentice groped his way, and stopping at a house from whose defaced and rotten front the rude effigy of a bottle swung to and fro like some gibbeted malefactor, struck thrice upon an iron grating with his foot. After listening in vain for some response to his signal, Mr. Tapperty became impatient, and struck the grating thrice again. A further delay ensued, but it was not of long duration. The ground seemed to open at his feet, and a ragged head appeared. "Is that the captain?" said a voice as ragged as the head. "Yes," replied Mr. Tapperty haughtily, descending as he spoke, "who should it be?" "It's so late, we gave you up," returned the voice, as its owner stopped to shut and fasten the grating. "You were late, sir." "Lead on," said Mr. Tapperty, with a gloomy majesty, "and make remarks when I require you. Forward." This latter word of command was perhaps somewhat theatrical and unnecessary, inasmuch as the descent was by a very narrow, steep, and slippery flight of steps, and any rashness or departure from the beaten track must have ended in a yawning water butt. But Mr. Tapperty being, like some other great commanders, favorable to strong effects, and personal display, cried forward. Again, in the hoarsest voice he could assume, and led the way, with folded arms and knitted brows, to the cellar down below, where there was a small copper fixed in one corner, a chair or two, a form and table, a glimmering fire, and a truckle bed, covered with a ragged patchwork rug. "Welcome, noble captain," cried a lanky figure, rising as from a nap. The captain nodded. Then, throwing off his outer coat, he stood composed in all his dignity, and eyed his follower over. "What news tonight?" he asked, when he had looked into his very soul. "Nothing particular," replied the other, stretching himself, and he was so long already that it was quite alarming to see him do it. "How come you to be so late?" "No matter," was all the captain deigned to say in answer. "Is the room prepared?" "It is," replied the follower. "The comrade, is he here?"
"Yes."
"And a sprinkling of the others, you hear 'em?"
"Playing skittles," said the captain moodily. "Light-hearted revelers." There was no doubt respecting the particular amusement in which these heedless spirits were indulging, for even in the close and stifling atmosphere of the vault, the noise sounded like distant thunder. It certainly appeared, at first sight, a singular spot to choose, for that or any other purpose of relaxation, if the other cellars answered to the one in which this brief colloquy took place, for the floors were of sodden earth, the walls and roof of damp bare brick tapestried with the tracks of snails and slugs, the air was sickening, tainted, and offensive. It seemed, from one strong flavor which was uppermost among the various odors of the place, that it had, at no very distant period, been used as a storehouse for cheeses, a circumstance which, while it accounted for the greasy moisture that hung about it,
was agreeably suggestive of rats. It was naturally damp besides, and little trees of fungus sprung from every moldering corner. The proprietor of this charming retreat, and owner of the Ragged Head before mentioned, for he wore an old tie wig as Baron Frowsy as a stunted hearth broom, had by this time joined them, and stood a little apart, rubbing his hands, wagging his hoary bristled chin, and smiling in silence. His eyes were closed, but had they been wide open, it would have been easy to tell, from the attentive expression of the face he turned towards them, pale and unwholesome as might be expected in one of his underground existence, and from a certain anxious raising and quivering of the lids, that he was blind. "Even Stag hath been asleep," said the long comrade, nodding towards this person. "Sound, captain, sound," cried the blind man. "What does my noble captain drink? Is it brandy, rum, usquebaugh? Is it soaked gunpowder, or blazing oil? Give it a name, heart of oak, and we'd get it for you, if it was wine from a bishop's cellar, or melted gold from King George's mint."
"See," said Mr. Tapperty haughtily, "that it's something strong, and comes quick, and so long as you take care of that, you may bring it from the devil's cellar, if you like."
"Boldly said, noble captain," rejoined the blind man. "Spoken like the prentice's glory. Ha, ha. From the devil's cellar. A brave joke. The captain joketh. Ha, ha, ha." "I'll tell you what, my fine feller," said Mr. Tapperty, eyeing the host over as he walked to a closet, and took out a bottle and glass as carelessly as if he had been in full possession of his sight, "if you make that row, you'll find that the captain's very far from joking, and so I tell you. He's got his eyes on me," cried Stag, stopping short on his way back, and affecting to screen his face with the bottle. "I feel him though I can't see him. Take him off, noble captain. Remove him, for they pierce like gimlets." Mr. Tapperty smiled grimly at his comrade, and twisting out one more look, a kind of ocular screw under the influence of which the blind man feigned to undergo great anguish and torture, bade him, in a softened tone, approach, and hold his peace.
"I obey you, captain," cried Stag, drawing close to him and filling out a bumper without spilling a drop, by reason that he held his little finger at the brim of the glass, and stopped at the instant the liquor touched it. "Drink, noble governor. Death to all masters, life to all prentices, and love to all fair damsels. Drink, brave general, and warm your gallant heart." Mr. Tapperty condescended to take the glass from his outstretched hand. Stag then dropped on one knee, and gently smoothed the calves of his legs, with an air of humble admiration. "That I had but eyes," he cried, "to behold my captain's symmetrical proportions. That I had but eyes, to look upon these twin invaders of domestic peace." "Get out," said Mr. Tapperty, glancing downward at his favorite limbs. "Go along, will you, Stag?"
"When I touch my own afterwards," cried the host, smiting them reproachfully, "I hate 'em. Comparatively speaking, they've no more shape than wooden legs, beside these models of my noble captain's."
"Yours?" exclaimed Mr. Tapperty.
"No, I should think not. Don't talk about those precious old toothpicks in the same breath with mine, that's rather too much. Here, take the glass. Benjamin, lead on. To business." With these words, he folded his arms again, and frowning with a sullen majesty, passed with his companion through a little door at the upper end of the cellar, and disappeared, leaving Stag to his private meditations. The vault they entered, strewn with sawdust and dimly lighted, was between the outer one from which they had just come, and that in which the skittle players were diverting themselves, as was manifested by the increased noise and clamor of tongues, which was suddenly stopped, however, and replaced by a dead silence, at a signal from the long comrade. Then, this young gentleman, going to a little cupboard, returned with a thigh bone, which in former times must have been part and parcel of some individual at least as long as himself, and placed the same in the hands of Mr. Tapperty, who, receiving it as a scepter and staff of authority, cocked his three-cornered hat fiercely on the top of his head, and mounted a large table, whereon a chair of state, cheerfully ornamented with a couple of skulls, was placed ready for his reception. He had no sooner assumed this position, than another young gentleman appeared, bearing in his arms a huge clasped book, who made him a profound obeisance, and delivering it to the long comrade, advanced to the table, and turning his back upon it, stood there atlas-wise. Then, the long comrade got upon the table too, and seating himself in a lower chair than Mr. Tapperty's, with much state and ceremony, placed the large book on the shoulders of their mute companion as deliberately as if he had been a wooden desk, and prepared to make entries therein with a pen of corresponding size. When the long comrade had made these preparations, he looked towards Mr. Tapperty, and Mr. Tapperty, flourishing the bone, knocked 9 times therewith upon one of the skulls. At the 9th stroke, a 3rd young gentleman emerged from the door leading to the skittle ground, and bowing low, awaited his commands.
"Prentice," said the mighty captain, "who waits without?"
The prentice made answer that a stranger was in attendance, who claimed admission into that secret society of prentice knights, and a free participation in their rights, privileges, and immunities. Thereupon Mr. Tapperty flourished the bone again, and giving the other skull a prodigious rap on the nose, exclaimed, "Admit him." At these dread words the prentice bowed once more, and so withdrew as he had come. There soon appeared at the same door, 2 other prentices, having between them a 3rd, whose eyes were bandaged, and who was attired in a bag wig, and a broad-skirted coat, trimmed with tarnished lace, and who was girded with a sword, in compliance with the laws of the institution regulating the introduction of candidates, which required them to assume this courtly dress, and kept it constantly in lavender, for their convenience. One of the conductors of this novice held a rusty blunderbuss pointed towards his ear, and the other a very ancient saber, with which he carved imaginary offenders as he came along in a sanguinary and anatomical manner. As this silent group advanced, Mr. Tapperty fixed his hat upon his head. The novice then laid his hand upon his breast and bent before him. When he had humbled himself sufficiently, the captain ordered the bandage to be removed, and proceeded to eye him over.
"Ha!" said the captain, thoughtfully, when he had concluded this ordeal. "Proceed." The long comrade read aloud as follows: "Mark Gilbert. Age, 19. Bound to Thomas Curzon, hosier, Golden Fleece, Aldgate. Loves Curzon's daughter. Cannot say that Curzon's daughter loves him. Should think it probable. Curzon pulled his ears last Tuesday week."
"How?" cried the captain, starting.
"For looking at his daughter, please you," said the novice.
"Write Curzon down, denounced," said the captain. "Put a black cross against the name of Curzon."
"So please you," said the novice, "that's not the worst. He calls his prentice idle dog, and stops his beer unless he works to his liking. He gives Dutch cheese, too, eating Cheshire, sir, himself, and Sundays out, are only once a month."
"This," said Mr. Tappert gravely, "is a flagrant case. Put 2 black crosses to the name of Curzon."
"If the society," said the novice, who was an ill-looking, one-sided, shambling lad, with sunken eyes set close together in his head, "if the society would burn his house down for his not insured, or beat him as he comes home from his club at night, or help me to carry off his daughter, and marry her at the Fleet, whether she gave consent or no."
Mr. Tapperty waved his grisly truncheon as an admonition to him not to interrupt, and ordered 3 black crosses to the name of Curzon.
"Which means," he said in gracious explanation, "vengeance, complete and terrible. Prentice, do you love the Constitution?"
To which the novice, being to that end instructed by his attendant sponsors, replied, "I do."
"The church, the state, and everything established but the masters?"
quoth the captain.
Again the novice said, "I do."
Having said it, he listened meekly to the captain, who in an address prepared for such occasions, told him how that under that same constitution, which was kept in a strong box somewhere, but where exactly he could not find out, or he would have endeavored to procure a copy of it, the prentices had, in times gone by, had frequent holidays of right, broken people's heads by scores, defied their masters, nay, even achieved some glorious murders in the streets, which privileges had gradually been wrested from them, and in all which noble aspirations they were now restrained, how the degrading checks imposed upon them were unquestionably attributable to the innovating spirit of the times, and how they united therefore to resist all change, except such change as would restore those good old English customs, by which they would stand or fall. After illustrating the wisdom of going backward, by reference to that sagacious fish, the crab, and the not unfrequent practice of the mule and donkey, he described their general objects, which were briefly vengeance on their tyrant masters, of whose grievous and insupportable oppression no prentice could entertain a moment's doubt, and the restoration, as aforesaid, of their ancient rights and holidays, for neither of which objects were they now quite ripe, being barely 20 strong, but which they pledged themselves to pursue with fire and sword when needful. Then he described the oath which every member of that small remnant of a noble body took, and which was of a dreadful and impressive kind, binding him, at the bidding of his chief, to resist and obstruct the Lord Mayor, sword-bearer, and chaplain, to despise the authority of the sheriffs, and to hold a court of aldermen as naught, but not on any account, in case the fullness of time should bring a general rising of prentices, to damage or in any way disfigure Temple Bar, which was strictly constitutional and always to be approached with reverence. having gone over these several heads with great eloquence and force, and having further informed the novice that this society had its origin in his own teeming brain, stimulated by a swelling sense of wrong and outrage, Mr. Tapperty demanded whether he had strength of heart to take the mighty pledge required, or whether he would withdraw while retreat was yet in his power. To this the novice made rejoinder, that he would take the vow, though it should choke him, and it was accordingly administered with many impressive circumstances, among which the lighting up of the two skulls with a candle end inside of each, and a great many flourishes with the bone, were chiefly conspicuous, not to mention a variety of grave exercises with the blunderbuss and saber, and some dismal groaning by unseen prentices without. All these dark and direful ceremonies being at length completed, the table was put aside, the chair of state removed, the scepter locked up in its usual cupboard, the doors of communication between the three cellars thrown freely open, and the prentice knights resigned themselves to merriment. But Mr. Tapperty, who had a soul above the vulgar herd, and who, on account of his greatness, could only afford to be merry now and then, threw himself on a bench with the air of a man who was faint with dignity. He looked with an indifferent eye, alike on skittles, cards, and dice, thinking only of the locksmith's daughter, and the base degenerate days on which he had fallen. "My noble captain neither games, nor sings, nor dances," said his host, taking a seat beside him. "Drink, gallant general." Mr. Tapperty drained the proffered goblet to the dregs, then thrust his hands into his pockets, and with a lowering visage walked among the skittles, while his followers, such is the influence of superior genius, restrained the ardent ball, and held his little shins in dumb respect. If I had been born a corsair or a pirate, a brigand, genteel highwayman or patriot, and they're the same thing, thought Mr. Tapperty, musing among the ninepins, I should have been all right. But to drag out an ignoble existence unbeknown to mankind and general patience. I will be famous yet. A voice within me keeps on whispering greatness. I shall burst out one of these days, and when I do, what power can keep me down? I feel my soul getting into my head at the idea. More drink there. The novice, pursued Mr. Tapperty, not exactly in a voice of thunder, for his tones, to say the truth, were rather cracked and shrill, but very impressively, notwithstanding, "Where is he?"
"Here, noble captain," cried Stagg. "One stands beside me who I feel as a stranger."
"Have you," said Mr. Tapperty, letting his gaze fall on the party indicated, who was indeed the new knight, by this time restored to his own apparel, "have you the impression of your street door key in wax?" The long comrade anticipated the reply, by producing it from the shelf on which it had been deposited.
"Good," said Mr. Tapperty, scrutinizing it attentively, while a breathless silence reigned around, for he had constructed secret door keys for the whole society, and perhaps owed something of his influence to that mean and trivial circumstance on such slight accidents do even men of mind depend. "This is easily made. Come hither, friend." With that, he beckoned the new knight apart, and putting the pattern in his pocket, motioned to him to walk by his side. "And so," he said, when they had taken a few turns up and down, you love your master's daughter?"
"I do," said the prentice. "Honor bright. No chaff, you know."
"Have you," rejoined Mr. Tapperty, catching him by the wrist, and giving him a look which would have been expressive of the most deadly malevolence, but for an accidental hiccup that rather interfered with it, "have you a rival?"
"Not as I know on," replied the prentice.
"If you had now," said Mr. Tapperty, "what would you a dash?" The prentice looked fierce and clenched his fists.
"It is enough," cried Mr. Tapperty hastily, "we understand each other. We are observed. I thank you." So saying, he cast him off again, and calling the long comrade aside after taking a few hasty turns by himself, bade him immediately write and post against the wall a notice, proscribing one Joseph Willett, commonly known as Joe, of Chigwell, forbidding all prentice knights to succor, comfort, or hold communion with him, and requiring them, on pain of excommunication, to molest, hurt, wrong, annoy, and pick quarrels with the said Joseph, whensoever and wheresoever they, or any of them, should happen to encounter him. Having relieved his mind by this energetic proceeding, he condescended to approach the festive board, and warming by degrees, at length deigned to preside, and even to enchant the company with a song. After this, he rose to such a pitch as to consent to regale the society with a hornpipe, which he actually performed to the music of a fiddle, played by an ingenious member, with such surpassing agility and brilliancy of execution, that the spectators could not be sufficiently enthusiastic in their admiration, and their host protested, with tears in his eyes, that he had never truly felt his blindness until that moment. but the host, withdrawing probably to weep in secret, soon returned with the information that it wanted little more than an hour of day, and that all the cocks in Barbican had already begun to crow, as if their lives depended on it. At this intelligence, the prentice knights arose in haste, and marshalling into a line, filed off one by one and dispersed with all speed to their several homes, leaving their leader to pass the grating last. "Good night, noble captain," whispered the blind man as he held it open for his passage out. "Farewell, brave general. Bye, bye, illustrious commander. Good luck go with you for a conceited, bragging, empty-headed, duck-legged idiot." With which parting words, coolly added as he listened to his receding footsteps and locked the grate upon himself, he descended the steps, and lighting the fire below the little copper, prepared, without any assistance, for his daily occupation, which was to retail at the area head above pennyworths of broth and soup, and savory puddings, compounded of such scraps as were to be bought in the heap for the least money at Fleet Market in the evening time, and for the sale of which he had need to have depended chiefly on his private connection, for the court had no thoroughfare, and was not that kind of place in which many people were likely to take the air, or to frequent as an agreeable promenade. Chapter 9. Chroniclers are privileged to enter where they list, to come and go through keyholes, to ride upon the wind, to overcome, in their soarings up and down, all obstacles of distance, time, and place. Thrice blessed be this last consideration, since it enables us to follow the disdainful Miggs even into the sanctity of her chamber, and to hold her in sweet companionship through the dreary watches of the night. Miss Miggs, having undone her mistress, as she phrased it, which means, assisted to undress her, and having seen her comfortably to bed in the back room on the first floor, withdrew to her own apartment, in the attic story. Notwithstanding her declaration in the locksmith's presence, she was in no mood for sleep, so, putting her light upon the table and withdrawing the little window curtain, she gazed out pensively at the wild night sky. Perhaps she wondered what star was destined for her habitation when she had run her little course below, perhaps speculated which of those glimmering spheres might be the natal orb of Mr. Tappertit, perhaps marveled how they could gaze down on that perfidious creature, man, and not sicken and turn green as chemist's lamps, perhaps thought of nothing in particular. Whatever she thought about, there she sat, until her attention, alive to anything connected with the insinuating prentice, was attracted by a noise in the next room to her own's room, the room in which he slept, and dreamed it might be, sometimes dreamed of her. That he was not dreaming now, unless he was taking a walk in his sleep, was clear, for every now and then there came a shuffling noise, as though he were engaged in polishing the whitewashed wall, then a gentle creaking of his door, then the faintest indication of his stealthy footsteps on the landing place outside. Noting this latter circumstance, Miss Miggs turned pale and shuddered, as mistrusting his intentions, and more than once exclaimed, below her breath, "Oh! What a providence it is," as I am bolted an exclamation mark which, owing doubtless to her alarm, was a confusion of ideas on her part between a bolt and its use, for though there was one on the door, it was not fastened. Miss Miggs's sense of hearing, however, having as sharp an edge as her temper, and being of the same snappish and suspicious kind, very soon informed her that the footsteps passed her door, and appeared to have some object quite separate and disconnected from herself. At this discovery she became more alarmed than ever, and was about to give utterance to those cries of thieves and murder, which she had hitherto restrained, when it occurred to her to look softly out, and see that her fears had some good palpable foundation. Looking out accordingly, and stretching her neck over the handrail, she descried, to her great amazement, Mr. Tappertit completely dressed, stealing downstairs, one step at a time, with his shoes in one hand and a lamp in the other. Following him with her eyes, and going down a little way herself to get the better of an intervening angle, she beheld him thrust his head in at the parlor door, draw it back again with great swiftness, and immediately begin a retreat upstairs with all possible expedition. "Here's mysteries," said the damsel, when she was safe in her own room again, quite out of breath. "Oh, gracious, here's mysteries." The prospect of finding anybody out in anything would have kept Miss Miggs awake under the influence of henbane. Presently, she heard the step again, as she would have done if it had been that of a feather endowed with motion and walking down on tiptoe. Then gliding out as before, she again beheld the retreating figure of the prentice. Again he looked cautiously in at the parlor door, but this time instead of retreating, he passed in and disappeared. Miggs was back in her room, and had her head out of the window, before an elderly gentleman could have winked and recovered from it. Out he came at the street door, shut it carefully behind him, tried it with his knee, and swaggered off, putting something in his pocket as he went along. At this spectacle Miggs cried gracious. Again, and then goodness gracious. And then goodness gracious me. And then, candle in hand, went downstairs as he had done. Coming to the workshop, she saw the lamp burning on the forge, and everything as Sim had left it. Why, I wish I may only have a walking funeral, and never be buried decent with a mourning coach and feathers, if the boy hasn't been and made a key for his own self, cried Miggs. Oh, the little villain. This conclusion was not arrived at without consideration, and much peeping and peering about, nor was it unassisted by the recollection that she had on several occasions come upon the prentice suddenly, and found him busy at some mysterious occupation. Lest the fact of Miss Miggs calling him, on whom she stooped to cast a favorable eye, a boy, should create surprise in any breast, it may be observed that she invariably affected to regard all male bipeds under 30 as mere chits and infants, which phenomenon is not unusual in ladies of Miss Miggs's temper, and is indeed generally found to be the associate of such indomitable and savage virtue. Miss Miggs deliberated within herself for some little time, looking hard at the shop door while she did so, as though her eyes and thoughts were both upon it, and then, taking a sheet of paper from a drawer, twisted it into a long thin spiral tube. Having filled this instrument with a quantity of small coal dust from the forge, she approached the door, and dropping on one knee before it, dexterously blew into the keyhole as much of these fine ashes as the lock would hold. When she had filled it to the brim in a very workmanlike and skillful manner, she crept upstairs again, and chuckled as she went. "There," cried Miggs, rubbing her hands, "now let's see whether you won't be glad to take some notice of me, mister. He. You'll have eyes for somebody besides Miss Dolly now, I think. A fat-faced puss she is, as ever I come across." As she uttered this criticism, she glanced approvingly at her small mirror, as who should say, "I thank my stars that can't be said of me." As it certainly could not, for Miss Miggs's style of beauty was of that kind which Mr. Tappertit himself had not inaptly termed, in private, scraggy. "I don't go to bed this night," said Miggs, wrapping herself in a shawl, and drawing a couple of chairs near the window, flouncing down upon one, and putting her feet upon the other, "till you come home, my lad." "I wouldn't," said Miggs viciously, "no, not for 45 pound. With that, and with an expression of face in which a great number of opposite ingredients, such as mischief, cunning, malice, triumph, and patient expectation, were all mixed up together in a kind of physiognomical punch, Miss Miggs composed herself to wait and listen, like some ferrogress who had set a trap and was watching for a nibble from a plump young traveller. She sat there, with perfect composure, all night. At length, just upon break of day, there was a footstep in the street, and presently she could hear Mr. Tappertit stop at the door. Then she could make out that he tried his key, that he was blowing into it, that he knocked it on the nearest post to beat the dust out, that he took it under a lamp to look at it, that he poked bits of stick into the lock to clear it, that he peeped into the keyhole, first with one eye, and then with the other, that he tried the key again, that he couldn't turn it, and what was worse, couldn't get it out, that he bent it, that then it was much less disposed to come out than before, that he gave it a mighty twist and a great pull, and then it came out so suddenly that he staggered backwards, that he kicked the door, that he shook it finally, that he smote his forehead, and sat down on the step in despair. When this crisis had arrived, Miss Miggs, affecting to be exhausted with terror, and to cling to the windowsill for support, put out her nightcap, and demanded in a faint voice who was there. Mr. Tappertit cried hush, and, backing to the road, exhorted her in frenzied pantomime to secrecy and silence. "Tell me one thing," said Miggs. "Is it thieves?"
No,
cried Mr. Tappertit. "Then," said Miggs, more faintly than before, "it's fire."
"Where is it, sir?"
"It's near this room, I know. I've a good conscience, sir, and would much rather die than go down a ladder. All I wish is, respecting my love to my married sister, Golden Lion Court, number 27, second bell handle on the right-hand doorpost."
"Miggs," cried Mr. Tappertit, "don't you know me?
Sim, you know Sim."
"Oh, what about him?"
cried Miggs, clasping her hands. "Is he in any danger? Is he in the midst of flames and blazes? Oh, gracious, gracious."
"Why, I'm here, ain't I?"
rejoined Mr. Tappertit, knocking himself on the breast. "Don't you see me? What a fool you are, Miggs."
"There," cried Miggs, unmindful of this compliment.
"Why so at goodness, what is the meaning of if you please, M.I.M., here's?"
No,
cried Mr. Tappertit, standing on tiptoe, as if by that means he, in the street, were any nearer being able to stop the mouth of Miggs in the garret.
"Don't.
I've been out without leave, and something or another's the matter with the lock. Come down, and undo the shop window, that I may get in that way."
"I dursn't do it, Simeon,"
cried Miggs, for that was her pronunciation of his Christian name.
I durstn't do it, indeed. You know as well as anybody how particular I am. And to come down in the dead of night, when the house is wrapped in slumbers and wild in obscurity. And there she stopped and shivered, for her modesty caught cold at the very thought.
But Miggs, cried Mr. Tappertit, getting under the lamp, that she might see his eyes. My darling Miggs. Miggs screamed slightly. That I love so much, and never can help thinking of, and it is impossible to describe the use he made of his eyes when he said this, do for my sake, do.
Oh Simeon, cried Miggs, this is worse than all. I know if I come down, you'll go, and.
And what, my precious? Said Mr. Tappertit.
And try, said Miggs, hysterically, to kiss me, or some such dreadfulness, I know you will.
I swear I won't, said Mr. Tappertit, with remarkable earnestness. Upon my soul I won't. It's getting broad day, and the watchman's waking up. Angelic Miggs. If you'll only come and let me in, I promise you faithfully and truly I won't.
Miss Miggs, whose gentle heart was touched, did not wait for the oath, knowing how strong the temptation was, and fearing he might forswear himself, but tripped lightly down the stairs, and with her own fair hands drew back the rough fastenings of the workshop window. Having helped the wayward prentice in, she faintly articulated the words Simeon is safe. And yielding to her woman's nature, immediately became insensible.
I knew I should quench her, said Sim, rather embarrassed by this circumstance. Of course I was certain it would come to this, but there was nothing else to be done. If I hadn't eyed her over, she wouldn't have come down. Here. Keep up a minute, Miggs. What a slippery figure she is. There's no holding her, comfortably. Do keep up a minute, Miggs, will you?
As Miggs, however, was deaf to all entreaties, Mr. Tappertit leant her against the wall as one might dispose of a walking stick or umbrella, until he had secured the window, when he took her in his arms again, and, in short stages and with great difficulty arising from her being tall and his being short, and perhaps in some degree from that peculiar physical conformation on which he had already remarked, carried her upstairs, and planting her, in the same umbrella and walking stick fashion, just inside her own door, left her to her repose.
He may be as cool as he likes, said Miss Miggs, recovering as soon as she was left alone, but I'm in his confidence and he can't help himself, nor couldn't if he was 20 Simeons's. Chapter 10. It was on one of those mornings, common in early spring, when the year, fickle and changeable in its youth like all other created things, is undecided whether to step backward into winter or forward into summer, and in its uncertainty inclines now to the one and now to the other, and now to both at once wooing summer in the sunshine, and lingering still with winter in the shade. It was, in short, on one of those mornings, when it is hot and cold, wet and dry, bright and lowering, sad and cheerful, withering and genial, in the compass of one short hour, that old John Willett, who was dropping asleep over the copper boiler, was roused by the sound of a horse's feet, and glancing out at window, beheld a traveller of goodly promise, checking his bridle at the maypole door. He was none of your flippant young fellows, who would call for a tankard of mulled ale, and make themselves as much at home as if they had ordered a hogshead of wine, none of your audacious young swaggerers, who would even penetrate into the bar that solemn sanctuary and, smiting old John upon the back, inquire if there was never a pretty girl in the house, and where he hid his little chambermaids, with 100 other impertinences of that nature, none of your free and easy companions, who would scrape their boots upon the fire dogs in the common room, and be not at all particular on the subject of spittoons, none of your unconscionable blades, requiring impossible chops, and taking unheard of pickles for granted. He was a staid, grave, placid gentleman, something past the prime of life, yet upright in his carriage, for all that, and slim as a greyhound. He was well mounted upon a sturdy chestnut cob, and had the graceful seat of an experienced horseman, while his riding gear, though free from such fopperies as were then in vogue, was handsome and well chosen. He wore a riding coat of a somewhat brighter green than might have been expected to suit the taste of a gentleman of his years, with a short, black velvet cape, and laced pocket holes and cuffs, all of a jaunty fashion. His linen, too, was of the finest kind, worked in a rich pattern at the wrists and throat, and scrupulously white. Although he seemed, judging from the mud he had picked up on the way, to have come from London, his horse was as smooth and cool as his own iron gray periwig and pigtail. Neither man nor beast had turned a single hair, and saving for his soiled skirts and spattered dashes, this gentleman, with his blooming face, white teeth, exactly ordered dress, and perfect calmness, might have come from making an elaborate and leisurely toilet, to sit for an equestrian portrait at old John Willett's gate. It must not be supposed that John observed these several characteristics by other than very slow degrees, or that he took in more than half a one at a time, or that he even made up his mind upon that, without a great deal of very serious consideration. Indeed, if he had been distracted in the first instance by questionings and orders, it would have taken him at the least a fortnight to have noted what is here set down, but it happened that the gentleman, being struck with the old house, or with the plump pigeons which were skimming and curtsying about it, or with the tall maypole, on the top of which a weathercock, which had been out of order for 15 years, performed a perpetual walk to the music of its own creaking, sat for some little time looking round in silence. Hence John, standing with his hand upon the horse's bridle, and his great eyes on the rider, and with nothing passing to divert his thoughts, had really got some of these little circumstances into his brain by the time he was called upon to speak. "A quaint place this," said the gentleman, and his voice was as rich as his dress. "Are you the landlord?"
"At your service, sir," replied John Willet.
"You can give my horse good stabling, can you, and me an early dinner, I am not particular what, so that it be cleanly served, and a decent room of which there seems to be no lack in this great mansion," said the stranger, again running his eyes over the exterior.
"You can have, sir," returned John with a readiness quite surprising, "anything you please."
"It's well I am easily satisfied," returned the other with a smile, "or that might prove a hearty pledge, my friend." And saying so, he dismounted, with the aid of the block before the door, in a twinkling.
"Holloa there, Hugh!" roared John. "I ask your pardon, sir, for keeping you standing in the porch, but my son has gone to town on business, and the boy being, as I may say, of a kind of use to me, I'm rather put out when he's away.
Hugh! A dreadful idle vagrant fellow, sir, half a gypsy, as I think, always sleeping in the sun in summer, and in the straw in winter time, Sir Hugh! Dear Lord, to keep a gentleman awaiting here through him!
Hugh! I wish that chap was dead, I do indeed."
"Possibly he is," returned the other. "I should think if he were living, he would have heard you by this time."
"In his fits of laziness, he sleeps so desperate hard," said the distracted host, "that if you were to fire off cannonballs into his ears, it wouldn't wake him, sir."
The guest made no remark upon this novel cure for drowsiness, and recipe for making people lively, but, with his hands clasped behind him, stood in the porch, very much amused to see old John, with the bridle in his hand, wavering between a strong impulse to abandon the animal to his fate, and a half disposition to lead him into the house, and shut him up in the parlor, while he waited on his master.
"Pillory the fellow, here he is at last!" cried John, in the very height and zenith of his distress. "Did you hear me a-calling, villain?"
The figure he addressed made no answer, but putting his hand upon the saddle, sprung into it at a bound, turned the horse's head towards the stable, and was gone in an instant.
"Brisk enough when he is awake," said the guest.
"Brisk enough, sir," replied John, looking at the place where the horse had been, as if not yet understanding quite what had become of him.
"He melts, I think. He goes like a drop of froth. You look at him, and there he is. You look at him again, and there he isn't."
Having, in the absence of any more words, put this sudden climax to what he had faintly intended should be a long explanation of the whole life and character of his man, the oracular John Willet led the gentleman up his wide dismantled staircase into the Maypole's best apartment. It was spacious enough in all conscience, occupying the whole depth of the house, and having at either end a great bay window, as large as many modern rooms, in which some few panes of stained glass, emblazoned with fragments of armorial bearings, though cracked, and patched, and shattered, yet remained, attesting, by their presence, that the former owner had made the very light subservient to his state, and pressed the sun itself into his list of flatterers, bidding it, when it shone into his chamber, reflect the badges of his ancient family, and take new hues and colors from their pride. But those were old days, and now every little ray came and went as it would, telling the plain, bare, searching truth. Although the best room of the inn, it had the melancholy aspect of grandeur and decay, and was much too vast for comfort. Rich rustling hangings, waving on the walls, and, better far, the rustling of youth and beauty's dress, the light of women's eyes, outshining the tapers in their own rich jewels, the sound of gentle tongues, and music, and the tread of maiden feet, had once been there, and filled it with delight. But they were gone, and with them all its gladness. It was no longer a home, children were never born and bred there, the fireside had become mercenary, a something to be bought and sold, a very courtesan, let who would die, or sit beside, or leave it, it was still the same, it missed nobody, cared for nobody, had equal warmth and smiles for all. God help the man whose heart ever changes with the world, as an old mansion when it becomes an inn. No effort had been made to furnish this chilly waste, but before the broad chimney a colony of chairs and tables had been planted on a square of carpet, flanked by a ghostly screen, enriched with figures, grinning and grotesque. After lighting with his own hands the faggots which were heaped upon the hearth, old John withdrew to hold grave counsel with his cook, touching the stranger's entertainment, while the guest himself, seeing small comfort in the yet unkindled wood, opened a lattice in the distant window, and basked in a sickly gleam of cold March sun. Leaving the window now and then, to rake the crackling logs together, or pace the echoing room from end to end, he closed it when the fire was quite burned up, and having wheeled the easiest chair into the warmest corner, summoned John Willett.
"Sir," said John. He wanted pen, ink, and paper. There was an old standish on the mantelshelf containing a dusty apology for all three. Having set this before him, the landlord was retiring, when he motioned him to stay. "There is a house not far from here," said the guest when he had written a few lines, "which you call the Warren, I believe?" As this was said in the tone of one who knew the fact, and asked the question as a thing of course, John contented himself with nodding his head in the affirmative, at the same time taking one hand out of his pockets to cough behind, and then putting it in again. "I want this note," said the guest, glancing on what he had written, and folding it, "conveyed there without loss of time, and an answer brought back here. Have you a messenger at hand?" John was thoughtful for a minute or thereabouts, and then said yes. "Let me see him," said the guest. This was disconcerting, for Joe being out, and Hugh engaged in rubbing down the chestnut cob, he designed sending on the errand, Barnaby, who had just then arrived in one of his rambles, and who, so that he thought himself employed on a grave and serious business, would go anywhere. "Why, the truth is," said John after a long pause, "that the person who'd go quickest, is a sort of natural, as one may say, sir, and though quick of foot, and as much to be trusted as the post itself, he's not good at talking, being touched and flighty, sir."
"You don't," said the guest, raising his eyes to John's fat face, "you don't mean what's the fellow's name, you don't mean Barnaby?"
"Yes, I do," returned the landlord, his features turning quite expressive with surprise.
"How comes he to be here?" inquired the guest, leaning back in his chair, speaking in the bland, even tone, from which he never varied, and with the same soft, courteous, never-changing smile upon his face. "I saw him in London last night."
"He's, forever, here one hour, and there the next," returned old John, after the usual pause to get the question in his mind. "Sometimes he walks, and sometimes runs. He's known along the road by everybody, and sometimes comes here in a cart or chaise, and sometimes riding double. He comes and goes, through wind, rain, snow, and hail, and on the darkest nights. Nothing hurts him."
"He goes off into the Warren, does he not?" said the guest carelessly. "I seem to remember his mother telling me something to that effect yesterday. But I was not attending to the good woman much."
"You were right, sir," John made answer, "he does. His father, sir, was murdered in that house."
"So I have heard," returned the guest, taking a gold toothpick from his pocket with the same sweet smile. "A very disagreeable circumstance for the family."
"Very," said John with a puzzled look, as if it occurred to him, dimly and afar off, that this might by possibility be a cool way of treating the subject.
"All the circumstances after a murder," said the guest soliloquizing, "must be dreadfully unpleasant, so much bustle and disturbance, no repose, a constant dwelling upon one subject and the running in and out, and up and down stairs, intolerable. I wouldn't have such a thing happen to anybody I was nearly interested in, on any account. 'Twould be enough to wear one's life out. You were going to say, friend," he added, turning to John again.
"Only that Mrs. Rudge lives on a little pension from the family, and that Barnaby's as free of the house as any cat or dog about it," answered John.
"Shall he do your errand, sir?"
"Oh yes," replied the guest.
"Oh certainly. Let him do it by all means. Please to bring him here that I may charge him to be quick. If he objects to come you may tell him it's Mr. Chester. He will remember my name, I dare say."
John was so very much astonished to find who his visitor was, that he could express no astonishment at all, by looks or otherwise, but left the room as if he were in the most placid and imperturbable of all possible conditions. It has been reported that when he got downstairs, he looked steadily at the boiler for 10 minutes by the clock, and all that time never once left off shaking his head, for which statement there would seem to be some ground of truth and feasibility, inasmuch as that interval of time did certainly elapse, before he returned with Barnaby to the guest's apartment.
"Come hither, lad," said Mr. Chester. "You know Mr. Geoffrey Haredale?" Barnaby laughed, and looked at the landlord as though he would say, "You hear him?" John, who was greatly shocked at this breach of decorum, clapped his finger to his nose, and shook his head in mute remonstrance.
"He knows him, sir," said John, frowning aside at Barnaby, "as well as you or I do."
"I haven't the pleasure of much acquaintance with the gentleman," returned his guest.
"You may have. Limit the comparison to yourself, my friend."
Although this was said with the same easy affability, and the same smile, John felt himself put down, and laying the indignity at Barnaby's door, determined to kick his raven, on the very first opportunity.
"Give that," said the guest, who had by this time sealed the note, and who beckoned his messenger towards him as he spoke, into Mr. Haredale's own hands.
"Wait for an answer, and bring it back to me here. If you should find that Mr. Haredale is engaged just now, tell him can he remember a message, landlord?"
"When he chooses, sir," replied John.
"He won't forget this one."
"How are you sure of that?"
John merely pointed to him as he stood with his head bent forward, and his earnest gaze fixed closely on his questioner's face, and nodded sagely.
"Tell him then, Barnaby, should he be engaged," said Mr. Chester, "that I shall be glad to wait his convenience here, and to see him, if he will call, at any time this evening. At the worst I can have a bed here, will it, I suppose?"
Old John, immensely flattered by the personal notoriety implied in this familiar form of address, answered, with something like a knowing look, "I should believe you could, sir," and was turning over in his mind various forms of eulogium, with the view of selecting one appropriate to the qualities of his best bed, when his ideas were put to flight by Mr. Chester giving Barnaby the letter, and bidding him make all speed away.
"Speed," said Barnaby, folding the little packet in his breast, "speed. If you want to see hurry and mystery, come here. Here." With that, he put his hand, very much to John Willett's horror, on the guest's fine broadcloth sleeve, and led him stealthily to the back window.
"Look down there," he said softly, "do you mark how they whisper in each other's ears, then dance and leap, to make believe they are in sport? Do you see how they stop for a moment, when they think there is no one looking, and mutter among themselves again, and then how they roll and gamble, delighted with the mischief they've been plotting? Look at 'em now. See how they whirl and plunge. And now they stop again, and whisper, cautiously together a little thinking, mind, how often I have lain upon the grass and watched them. I say, what is it that they plot and hatch? Do you know?"
"They are only clothes," returned the guest, "such as we wear, hanging on those lines to dry, and fluttering in the wind."
"Clothes," echoed Barnaby, looking close into his face, and falling quickly back.
"Ha ha! Why, how much better to be silly, than as wise as you. You don't see shadowy people there, like those that live in sleep, not you. Nor eyes in the knotted panes of glass, nor swift ghosts when it blows hard, nor do you hear voices in the air, nor see men stalking in the sky, not you. I lead a merrier life than you, with all your cleverness. You're the dull men. We're the bright ones. Ha! Ha! I'll not change with you, clever as you are, not I." With that, he waved his hat above his head, and darted off.
"A strange creature, upon my word," said the guest, pulling out a handsome box, and taking a pinch of snuff.
"He wants imagination," said Mr. Willett, very slowly, and after a long silence, "that's what he wants. I've tried to instill it into him, many and many's the time, but John added this in confidence he ain't made for it, that's the fact."
To record that Mr. Chester smiled at John's remark would be little to the purpose, for he preserved the same conciliatory and pleasant look at all times. He drew his chair nearer to the fire though, as a kind of hint that he would prefer to be alone, and John, having no reasonable excuse for remaining, left him to himself. Very thoughtful old John Willett was, while the dinner was preparing, and if his brain were ever less clear at one time than another, it is but reasonable to suppose that he addled it in no slight degree by shaking his head so much that day. That Mr. Chester, between whom and Mr. Haredale, it was notorious to all the neighborhood, a deep and bitter animosity existed, should come down there for the sole purpose, as it seemed, of seeing him, and should choose the Maypole for their place of meeting, and should send to him express, were stumbling blocks John could not overcome. The only resource he had, was to consult the boiler, and wait impatiently for Barnaby's return. But Barnaby delayed beyond all precedent. The visitor's dinner was served, removed, his wine was set, the fire replenished, the hearth clean swept, the light waned without, it grew dusk, became quite dark, and still no Barnaby appeared. Yet, though John Willett was full of wonder and misgiving, his guest sat cross-legged in the easy chair, to all appearance as little ruffled in his thoughts as in his dress, the same calm, easy, cool gentleman, without a care or a thought beyond his golden toothpick.
"Barnaby's late," John ventured to observe, as he placed a pair of tarnished candlesticks, some 3 feet high, upon the table, and snuffed the lights they held.
"He is rather so," replied the guest, sipping his wine. "He will not be much longer, I dare say."
John coughed and raked the fire together.
"As your roads bear no very good character, if I may judge from my son's mishap, though," said Mr. Chester, "and as I have no fancy to be knocked on the head, which is not only disconcerting at the moment, but places one, besides, in a ridiculous position with respect to the people who chance to pick one up, I shall stop here tonight. I think you said you had a bed to spare."
"Such a bed, sir," returned John Willett, "such a bed as few, even of the gentry's houses, own. A fixture here, sir. I've heard say that bedstead is nigh 200 years of age. Your noble son, a fine young gentleman, slept in it last, sir, half a year ago."
"Upon my life, a recommendation," said the guest, shrugging his shoulders and wheeling his chair nearer to the fire.
"See that it be well aired, Mr. Willett, and let a blazing fire be lighted there at once. This house is something damp and chilly."
John raked the faggots up again, more from habit than presence of mind, or any reference to this remark, and was about to withdraw, when a bounding step was heard upon the stair, and Barnaby came panting in.
"He'll have his foot in the stirrup in an hour's time," he cried, advancing. "He has been riding hard all day, has just come home, but will be in the saddle again as soon as he has eaten and drank, to meet his loving friend."
"Was that his message?" asked the visitor, looking up, but without the smallest discomposure, or at least without the show of any.
"All but the last words," Barnaby rejoined. "He meant those. I saw that, in his face."
"This for your pains," said the other, putting money in his hand, and glancing at him steadfastly. "This for your pains, sharp Barnaby."
"For Grip, and me, and Hugh, to share among us," he rejoined, putting it up, and nodding, as he counted it on his fingers.
"Grip 1, me 2, Hugh 3, the dog, the goat, the cat's well, we shall spend it pretty soon, I warn you. Stay. Look. Do you wise men see nothing there, now?"
He bent eagerly down on one knee, and gazed intently at the smoke, which was rolling up the chimney in a thick black cloud.
John Willett, who appeared to consider himself particularly and chiefly referred to under the term wise men, looked that way likewise, and with great solidity of feature.
"Now, where do they go to, when they spring so fast up there?" asked Barnaby, Why do they tread so closely on each other's heels, and why are they always in a hurry, which is what you blame me for, when I only take pattern by these busy folk about me?
More of them. Catching to each other's skirts, and as fast as they go, others come. What a merry dance it is. I would that Grip and I could frisk like that.
What has he in that basket at his back? Asked the guest after a few moments, during which Barnaby was still bending down to look higher up the chimney, and earnestly watching the smoke.
In this? He answered, jumping up, before John Willett could reply, shaking it as he spoke, and stooping his head to listen.
In this? What is there here? Tell him.
A devil, a devil, a devil! Cried a hoarse voice.
Here's money, said Barnaby, chinking it in his hand, money for a treat, Grip.
Hurrah! 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 Replied the raven, keep up your spirits. Never say die.
Bo, wow, wow!
Mr. Willett, who appeared to entertain strong doubts whether a customer in a laced coat and fine linen could be supposed to have any acquaintance even with the existence of such unpolite gentry as the bird claimed to belong to, took Barnaby off at this juncture, with the view of preventing any other improper declarations, and quitted the room with his very best bow. 1 Chapter 11. There was great news that night for the regular Maypole customers, to each of whom, as he straggled in to occupy his allotted seat in the chimney corner, John, with a most impressive slowness of delivery, and in an apoplectic whisper, communicated the fact that Mr. Chester was alone in the large room upstairs, and was waiting the arrival of Mr. Geoffrey Haredale, to whom he had sent a letter, doubtless of a threatening nature, by the hands of Barnaby, then and there present. For a little knot of smokers and solemn gossips, who had seldom any new topics of discussion, this was a perfect godsend. Here was a good, dark-looking mystery progressing under that very roof, brought home to the fireside, as it were, and enjoyable without the smallest pains or trouble. It is extraordinary what a zest and relish it gave to the drink, and how it heightened the flavor of the tobacco. Every man smoked his pipe with a face of grave and serious delight, and looked at his neighbor with a sort of quiet congratulation. Nay, it was felt to be such a holiday and special night, that, on the motion of little Solomon Daisy, every man, including John himself, put down his sixpence for a can of flip, which grateful beverage was brewed with all dispatch, and set down in the midst of them on the brick floor, both that it might simmer and stew before the fire, and that its fragrant steam, rising up among them, and mixing with the wreaths of vapor from their pipes, might shroud them in a delicious atmosphere of their own, and shut out all the world. The very furniture of the room seemed to mellow and deepen in its tone, the ceiling and walls looked blacker and more highly polished, the curtains of a ruddier red, the fire burned clear and high, and the crickets in the hearthstone chirped with a more than wonted satisfaction. There were present two, however, who showed but little interest in the general contentment. Of these, one was Barnaby himself, who slept, or, to avoid being beset with questions, feigned to sleep, in the chimney corner; the other, Hugh, who, sleeping too, lay stretched upon the bench on the opposite side, in the full glare of the blazing fire. The light that fell upon this slumbering form, showed it in all its muscular and handsome proportions. It was that of a young man, of a hale athletic figure, and a giant's strength, whose sunburnt face and swarthy throat, overgrown with jet black hair, might have served a painter for a model. Loosely attired, in the coarsest and roughest garb, with scraps of straw and hay his usual bed clinging here and there, and mingling with his uncombed locks, he had fallen asleep in a posture as careless as his dress. The negligence and disorder of the whole man, with something fierce and sullen in his features, gave him a picturesque appearance, that attracted the regards even of the Maypole customers who knew him well, and caused Long Parks to say that Hugh looked more like a poaching rascal tonight than ever he had seen him yet. "He's waiting here, I suppose," said Solomon, "to take Mr. Haredale's horse."
"That's it, sir," replied John Willett. "He's not often in the house, you know. He's more at his ease among horses than men. I look upon him as an animal himself."
Following up this opinion with a shrug that seemed meant to say, "We can't expect everybody to be like us," John put his pipe into his mouth again, and smoked like one who felt his superiority over the general run of mankind.
"That chap, sir," said John, taking it out again after a time, and pointing at him with the stem, "though he's got all his faculties about him bottled up and corked down, if I may say so, somewheres or another."
"Very good," said Parks, nodding his head. "A very good expression, Johnny. You'll be a-tackling somebody presently. You're in twig tonight, I see."
"Take care," said Mr. Willett, not at all grateful for the compliment, "that I don't tackle you, sir, which I shall certainly endeavor to do, if you interrupt me when I'm making observations. That chap, I was a-saying, though he has all his faculties about him, somewheres or another, bottled up and corked down, has no more imagination than Barnaby has. And why hasn't he?"
The three friends shook their heads at each other, saying by that action, without the trouble of opening their lips, "Do you observe what a philosophical mind our friend has?"
"Why hasn't he?" said John, gently striking the table with his open hand.
"Because they was never drawed out of him when he was a boy. That's why. What would any of us have been, if our fathers hadn't drawed our faculties out of us? What would my boy Joe have been, if I hadn't drawed his faculties out of him? Do you mind what I'm a-saying of, gentlemen?"
"Ah! We mind you," cried Parks. "Go on improving of us, Johnny."
"Consequently, then," said Mr. Willett, "that chap, whose mother was hung when he was a little boy, along with six others, for passing bad notes, and it's a blessed thing to think how many people are hung in batches every 6 weeks for that, and such like offenses, as showing how wide awake our government is, that chap that was then turned loose, and had to mind cows, and frighten birds away, and what not, for a few pence to live on, and so got on by degrees to mind horses, and to sleep in course of time in lofts and litter, instead of under haystacks and hedges, till at last he come to be ostler at the Maypole for his board and lodging and an annual trifle. That chap that can't read nor write, and has never had much to do with anything but animals, and has never lived in any way but like the animals he has lived among, is a animal. And," said Mr. Willett, arriving at his logical conclusion, "is to be treated accordingly."
"Willett," said Solomon Daisy, who had exhibited some impatience at the intrusion of so unworthy a subject on their more interesting theme, "when Mr. Chester come this morning, did he order the large room?"
"He signified, sir," said John, "that he wanted a large apartment."
"Yes. Certainly."
"Why then, I'll tell you what," said Solomon, speaking softly and with an earnest look. "He and Mr. Haredale are going to fight a duel in it."
Everybody looked at Mr. Willett, after this alarming suggestion. Mr. Willett looked at the fire, weighing in his own mind the effect which such an occurrence would be likely to have on the establishment.
"Well," said John, "I don't know, I am sure I remember that when I went up last, He had put the lights upon the mantelshelf. "It's as plain," returned Solomon, as the nose on Parks's face. Mr. Parks, who had a large nose, rubbed it, and looked as if he considered this a personal allusion. "They'll fight in that room. You know by the newspapers what a common thing it is for gentlemen to fight in coffee houses without seconds. One of them will be wounded or perhaps killed in this house." "That was a challenge that Barnaby took then, eh?" said John. "Enclosing a slip of paper with a measure of his sword upon it, I'll bet a guinea," answered the little man. "We know what sort of gentleman Mr. Haredale is. You have told us what Barnaby said about his looks, when he came back. Depend upon it, I'm right. Now, mind." The flip had no flavor till now. The tobacco had been of mere English growth, compared with its present taste. A deal in that great old rambling room upstairs, and the best bed ordered already for the wounded man. "Would it be swords or pistols, now?" said John. "Heaven knows. Perhaps both," returned Solomon. "The gentlemen wear swords, and may easily have pistols in their pockets. Most likely have, indeed. If they fire at each other without effect, then they'll draw, and go to work in earnest." A shade passed over Mr. Willett's face as he thought of broken windows and disabled furniture, but bethinking himself that one of the parties would probably be left alive to pay the damage, he brightened up again. "And then," said Solomon, looking from face to face, "then we shall have one of those stains upon the floor that never come out. If Mr. Haredale wins, depend upon it, it'll be a deep one, or if he loses, it will perhaps be deeper still, for he'll never give in unless he's beaten down. We know him better, eh?" "Better indeed," they whispered all together. "As to its ever being got out again," said Solomon, "I tell you it never will, or can be. Why, do you know that it has been tried, at a certain house we are acquainted with?" "The Warren," cried John. "No, sure." "Yes, sure, yes. It's only known by very few. It has been whispered about, though, for all that. They plane the board away, but there it was. They went deep, but it went deeper. They put new boards down, but there was one great spot that came through still, and showed itself in the old place. And harkee, draw nearer. Mr. Jeffrey made that room his study, and sits there, always, with his foot, as I have heard, upon it, and he believes, through thinking of it long and very much, that it will never fade until he finds the man who did the deed." As this recital ended, and they all drew closer round the fire, the tramp of a horse was heard without. "The very man!" cried John, starting up. "Hugh! Hugh!" The sleeper staggered to his feet, and hurried after him. John quickly returned, ushering in with great attention and deference, for Mr. Haredale was his landlord, the long-expected visitor, who strode into the room clanking his heavy boots upon the floor, and looking keenly round upon the bowing group, raised his hat in acknowledgement of their profound respect. "You have a stranger here, Willett, who sent to me," he said, in a voice which sounded naturally stern and deep. "Where is he?" "In the great room upstairs, sir," answered John. "Show the way. Your staircase is dark, I know. Gentlemen, good night." With that, he signed to the landlord to go on before, and went clanking out, and up the stairs, old John, in his agitation, ingeniously lighting everything but the way, and making a stumble at every second step. "Stop," he said, when they reached the landing. "I can announce myself. Don't wait." He laid his hand upon the door, entered, and shut it heavily. Mr. Willett was by no means disposed to stand there listening by himself, especially as the walls were very thick, so descended, with much greater alacrity than he had come up, and joined his friends below. Chapter 12. There was a brief pause in the stateroom of the Maypole, as Mr. Haredale tried the lock to satisfy himself that he had shut the door securely, and, striding up the dark chamber to where the screen enclosed a little patch of light and warmth, presented himself, abruptly and in silence, before the smiling guest. If the two had no greater sympathy in their inward thoughts than in their outward bearing and appearance, the meeting did not seem likely to prove a very calm or pleasant one. With no great disparity between them in point of years, they were, in every other respect, as unlike and far removed from each other as two men could well be. The one was soft-spoken, delicately made, precise, and elegant; the other, a burly square-built man, negligently dressed, rough and abrupt in manner, stern, and, in his present mood, forbidding both in look and speech. The one preserved a calm and placid smile, the other, a distrustful frown. The newcomer, indeed, appeared bent on showing by his every tone and gesture his determined opposition and hostility to the man he had come to meet. The guest who received him, on the other hand, seemed to feel that the contrast between them was all in his favor, and to derive a quiet exultation from it which put him more at his ease than ever.
"Haredale," said this gentleman, without the least appearance of embarrassment or reserve, "I am very glad to see you."
"Let us dispense with compliments. They are misplaced between us," returned the other, waving his hand, "and say plainly what we have to say. You have asked me to meet you. I am here. Why do we stand face to face again?"
"Still the same frank and sturdy character, I see."
"Good or bad, sir, I am," returned the other, leaning his arm upon the chimney-piece, and turning a haughty look upon the occupant of the easy-chair, "the man I used to be. I have lost no old likings or dislikings, my memory has not failed me by a hair's breadth. You ask me to give you a meeting. I say, I am here."
"Our meeting, Haredale," said Mr. Chester, tapping his snuff-box, and following with a smile the impatient gesture he had made perhaps unconsciously towards his sword, "is one of conference and peace, I hope?"
"I have come here," returned the other, "at your desire, holding myself bound to meet you, when and where you would. I have not come to bandy pleasant speeches, or hollow professions. You are a smooth man of the world, sir, and at such play have me at a disadvantage. The very last man on this earth with whom I would enter the lists to combat with gentle compliments and masked faces, is Mr. Chester, I do assure you. I am not his match at such weapons, and have reason to believe that few men are."
"You do me a great deal of honor, Haredale," returned the other, "most composedly, and I thank you. I will be frank with you."
"I beg your pardon, will be what?"
"Frank, open, perfectly candid."
"Ha!" cried Mr. Haredale, drawing his breath. "But don't let me interrupt you."
"So resolved am I to hold this course," returned the other, tasting his wine with great deliberation, "that I have determined not to quarrel with you, and not to be betrayed into a warm expression or a hasty word."
"There again," said Mr. Haredale, "you have me at a great advantage. Your self-command is not to be disturbed, when it will serve my purpose, you would say," rejoined the other, interrupting him with the same complacency.
"Granted. I allow it. And I have a purpose to serve now. So have you. I am sure our object is the same. Let us attain it like sensible men, who have ceased to be boys some time. Do you drink?"
"With my friends," returned the other.
"At least," said Mr. Chester, "you will be seated?"
"I will stand," returned Mr. Haredale impatiently, "on this dismantled, beggared hearth, and not pollute it, fallen as it is, with mockeries. Go on."
"You are wrong, Haredale," said the other, crossing his legs, and smiling as he held his glass up in the bright glow of the fire. "You are really very wrong. The world is a lively place enough, in which we must accommodate ourselves to circumstances, sail with the stream as glibly as we can, be content to take froth for substance, the surface for the depth, the counterfeit for the real coin. I wonder no philosopher has ever established that our globe itself is hollow. It should be, if nature is consistent in her works."
"You think it is, perhaps?"
"I should say," he returned, sipping his wine, "there could be no doubt about it. Well, we, in trifling with this jingling toy, have had the ill luck to jostle and fall out. We are not what the world calls friends, but we are as good and true and loving friends for all that, as 9 out of every 10 of those on whom it bestows the title. You have a niece, and I a son, a fine lad, Haredale, but foolish. They fall in love with each other, and form what this same world calls an attachment, meaning as something fanciful and false like the rest, which, if it took its own free time, would break like any other bubble. But it may not have its own free time, will not, if they are left alone, and the question is, shall we too, because society calls us enemies, stand aloof, and let them rush into each other's arms, when, by approaching each other sensibly, as we do now, we can prevent it, and part them."
"I love my niece," said Mr. Haredale, after a short silence. "It may sound strangely in your ears, but I love her."
"Strangely, my good fellow," cried Mr. Chester, lazily filling his glass again, and pulling out his toothpick. "Not at all. I like Ned too, or, as you say, love him, that's the word among such near relations. I'm very fond of Ned. He's an amazingly good fellow, and a handsome fellow, foolish and weak as yet, that's all. But the thing is, Haredale, for I'll be very frank, as I told you I would at first, independently of any dislike that you and I might have to being related to each other, and independently of the religious differences between us, and damn it, that's important, I couldn't afford a match of this description. Ned and I couldn't do it. It's impossible."
"Curb your tongue, in God's name, if this conversation is to last," retorted Mr. Haredale fiercely. "I have said I love my niece. Do you think that, loving her, I would ever fling her heart away on any man who had your blood in his veins?
You see, said the other, not at all disturbed, the advantage of being so frank and open. Just what I was about to add, upon my honor. I am amazingly attached to Ned, quite dote upon him, indeed, and even if we could afford to throw ourselves away, that very objection would be quite insuperable. I wish you'd take some wine.
Mark me, said Mr. Haredale, striding to the table, and laying his hand upon it heavily. If any man presumes to think that I, in word or deed, or in the wildest dream, ever entertained remotely the idea of Emma Haredale's favoring the suit of anyone who is akin to you in any way, I care not what he lies. He lies, and does me grievous wrong, in the mere thought.
Haredale, returned the other, rocking himself to and fro as an assent, and nodding at the fire, it's extremely manly, and really very generous in you, to meet me in this unreserved and handsome way. Upon my word, those are exactly my sentiments, only expressed with much more force and power than I could use. You know my sluggish nature, and will forgive me, I am sure. While I would restrain her from all correspondence with your son, and sever their intercourse here, though it should cause her death, said Mr. Haredale, who had been pacing to and fro, I would do it kindly and tenderly if I can. I have a trust to discharge, which my nature is not formed to understand, and, for this reason, the bare fact of there being any love between them comes upon me tonight, almost for the first time. I am more delighted than I can possibly tell you, rejoined Mr. Chester with the utmost blandness, to find my own impression so confirmed. You see the advantage of our having met. We understand each other. We quite agree. We have a most complete and thorough explanation, and we know what course to take. Why don't you taste your tenant's wine? It's really very good.
Pray who, said Mr. Haredale, have aided Emma, or your son? Who are their go-betweens, and agents do you know?
All the good people hereabouts, the neighborhood in general, I think, returned the other, with his most affable smile. The messenger I sent to you today, foremost among them all.
The idiot? Barnaby?
You are surprised? I am glad of that, for I was rather so myself.
Yes. I wrung that from his mother, a very decent sort of woman from whom, indeed, I chiefly learned how serious the matter had become, and so determined to ride out here today, and hold a parley with you on this neutral ground. You're stouter than you used to be, Haredale, but you look extremely well.
Our business, I presume, is nearly at an end, said Mr. Haredale, with an expression of impatience he was at no pains to conceal.
Trust me, Mr. Chester, my niece shall change from this time. I will appeal, he added in a lower tone, to her woman's heart, her dignity, her pride, her duty.
I shall do the same by Ned, said Mr. Chester, restoring some errant faggots to their places in the grate with the toe of his boot. If there is anything real in this world, it is those amazingly fine feelings and those natural obligations which must subsist between father and son. I shall put it to him on every ground of moral and religious feeling. I shall represent to him that we cannot possibly afford it, that I have always looked forward to his marrying well, for a genteel provision for myself in the autumn of life, that there are a great many clamorous dogs to pay, whose claims are perfectly just and right, and who must be paid out of his wife's fortune. In short, that the very highest and most honorable feelings of our nature, with every consideration of filial duty and affection, and all that sort of thing, imperatively demand that he should run away with an heiress.
And break her heart as speedily as possible? Said Mr. Haredale, drawing on his glove.
There Ned will act exactly as he pleases, returned the other, sipping his wine, that's entirely his affair. I wouldn't for the world interfere with my son, Haredale, beyond a certain point. The relationship between father and son, you know, is positively quite a holy kind of bond. Won't you let me persuade you to take one glass of wine?
Well. As you please, he added, helping himself again.
Chester, said Mr. Haredale, after a short silence, during which he had eyed his smiling face from time to time intently, you have the head and heart of an evil spirit in all matters of deception.
Your health, said the other, with a nod. But I have interrupted you.
If now, pursued Mr. Haredale, we should find it difficult to separate these young people, and break off their intercourse, if, for instance, you find it difficult on your side, what course do you intend to take?
Nothing plainer, my good fellow, nothing easier, returned the other, shrugging his shoulders and stretching himself more comfortably before the fire. I shall then exert those powers on which you flatter me so highly, though, upon my word, I don't deserve your compliments to their full extent, and resort to a few little trivial subterfuges for rousing jealousy and resentment. You see? In short, justifying the means by the end, we are, as a last resource for tearing them asunder,
to resort to treachery and in lying, said Mr. Haredale.
Oh dear no.
Fie, fie. Returned the other, relishing a pinch of snuff extremely. Not lying. Only a little management, a little diplomacy, a little intriguing, that's the word.
I wish, said Mr. Haredale, moving to and fro, and stopping, and moving on again, like one who was ill at ease, that this could have been foreseen or prevented. But as it has gone so far, and it is necessary for us to act, it is of no use shrinking or regretting.
Well. I shall second your endeavors to the utmost of my power. There is one topic in the whole wide range of human thoughts on which we both agree. We shall act in concert, but apart. There will be no need, I hope, for us to meet again.
Are you going? Said Mr. Chester, rising with a graceful indolence. Let me light you down the stairs.
Pray keep your seat, returned the other dryly, I know the way. So, waving his hand slightly, and putting on his hat as he turned upon his heel, he went clanking out as he had come, shut the door behind him, and tramped down the echoing stairs.
Pah! A very coarse animal, indeed! Said Mr. Chester, composing himself in the easy chair again. A rough brute. Quite a human badger.
John Willett and his friends, who had been listening intently for the clash of swords, or firing of pistols in the great room, and had indeed settled the order in which they should rush in when summoned, in which procession old John had carefully arranged that he should bring up the rear, were very much astonished to see Mr. Haredale come down without a scratch, call for his horse, and ride away thoughtfully at a foot pace. After some consideration, it was decided that he had left the gentleman above, for dead, and had adopted this stratagem to divert suspicion or pursuit. As this conclusion involved the necessity of their going upstairs forthwith, they were about to ascend in the order they had agreed upon, when a smart ringing at the guest's bell, as if he had pulled it vigorously, overthrew all their speculations, and involved them in great uncertainty and doubt. At length Mr. Willett agreed to go upstairs himself, escorted by Hugh and Barnaby, as the strongest and stoutest fellows on the premises, who were to make their appearance under pretense of clearing away the glasses. Under this protection, the brave and broad-faced John boldly entered the room, half a foot in advance, and received an order for a bootjack without trembling. But when it was brought, and he lent his sturdy shoulder to the guest, Mr. Willett was observed to look very hard into his boots as he pulled them off, and, by opening his eyes much wider than usual, to appear to express some surprise and disappointment at not finding them full of blood. He took occasion, too, to examine the gentleman